WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast. Hi, Jolene.
Hi, Peter.
Are you all recovered from the Super Bowl?
What? There was a Super Bowl?
Were you watching the Puppy Bowl?
I was. You caught me again this year.
On the Animal Planet channel, right?
Irresistible.
Anybody see that? Actually, it was quite a hoot. Anyway,
the hamsters and the blimp?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Goodbye.
Who?
You just said goodbye.
Oh, never mind.
Okay.
Peyton Manning, the quarterback for the Colts.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right.
And, you know, the big deal always with those is, because I never get real excited about one team or another, was the Lions. You know, I mean, I know that's a big joke and all that, but
yeah,
I would, I'd have some interest in it. But two teams that don't mean a lot to me.
Yeah, you know, if I didn't work on Sunday nights, I would probably get more excited because I'd be drinking.
There you go. That's what. But you know what it is? It's a nice national holiday, almost an international holiday, and it's a good excuse for people to get together and throw
and
down eat and drink and be merry.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. And there was, I was kind of like my wife said, why are you watching the commercials? And she doesn't understand.
That's the hype.
That's the hype. Yeah. So none of them. I didn't think they stood out. You know, the big deal was about Tim Tebow, that he was going to do this anti-abortion ad, and everybody was all whacked out about it and all that. And then it wasn't anything. I mean, you wouldn't even have known what it was about. It was his mom on there saying it was a difficult child, and it was kind of funny. He like tackles her and so.
So really much ado about nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
If you go to the stupid website that it's attached to, that's kind of a deal.
Let's not give it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give the website. No.
Right.
Well, Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan with you. We're at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
If you've had more than two brewskis, just listen, okay? This is nightmare night for talk radio.
It's been fun in the past.
Oh, I got an idea. If you've had more than two, why don't you email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Sometimes it's easier to convey your words.
Now, let's talk about a very important social gathering, the U.S. Social Forum. You all have heard of that, right? Everybody?
Wait, I hear crickets.
Yeah.
I know what it is.
And some of you have heard of it, because either there's probably a few of you listening that are involved in it, planning for it here in Detroit. Some of you have heard it on this show. I've mentioned it. Some of you have been to my website, peterwerbe.com. It's W-E-R-B-E. But for the rest of you scratching your heads, let me just let you scratch for a while and talk about another gathering. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I said I wasn't going to give any of these right-wingers any free publicity, because that's what the world has become. It's become totally mediatized, and people are media personalities. And if you're not a media personality, if you look like either, if you think about this, the two candidates that I said should have been running against one another in 2008 were Dennis Kucinich, congressman from Cleveland, and Ron Paul, the Republican from Texas.
Yeah.
Neither of them being very telegenic, right?
Right.
I mean, So in
more of a face for radio.
Exactly. That's why I'm in radio. Not Jolene, not
Peter.
Jolene. But, here you go. Come back here. In any event, there was another gathering, and
So what's your point, though? Your point is that they're not photogenic.
Yeah. So we got to go with the Ken and Barbies. Yeah.
Of course.
Right. Yeah. So 600 advocates of teabagging, which initially I thought was kind of cool, but then I realized that they didn't understand what it was all about.
Yeah, well, they started it.
Yeah, they were in Nashville over the weekend at the Gaylord Opryland, and some of them said they couldn't come because it was $550.
You couldn't afford it, right?
Plus fees, hotel, and transportation. Another 500 people said bought $350 tickets to hear Sarah Palin. So a total of about 1,100 people. $350 to hear Sarah Palin. If she was in my backyard, I wouldn't raise the window shade.
No, I wouldn't either. You know, I would quickly make a protest sign and flash it at her. But
I got to say, is there any politician that you would pay $350 to hear?
No, absolutely not. I saw the end of this little fiasco of hers down there, just when she was wrapping it up. And whoever the commentator, the moderator was just up her butt, you know. It was so disgusting. And her hair, by the way, bigger than ever.
Yeah, what is up with that?
Oh, boy. I mean, Barbie's getting bigger hair all the time. But they said, well, we know, and they made her sound just so special. Her time is so special. We know, Sarah, that this is so sad for everyone, but we know you have to go now. Where does she have to go? And they gave her $100,000 to do this. Can't she,
stretch it out.
Yeah,
she's off for another $100,000 speaking.
Boy. Which she's going to put back into the cause, she said, which I'd like to know what that is. Her happiness.
Well, now she is. She's not moving anywhere. She's just in Wasilla.
Oh yeah, Wasilla.
Wasilla.
Yeah,
sorry,
Fox News.
I won't even tell you what I confused there. But Wasilla, Alaska, that Fox News set up with these digs, right?
Yeah. Well, in her house, they built her a television studio. Which, Peter, I don't have much room to talk, because when you and I were syndicated, the network set up a studio in my house.
I would say
out over my pool.
But there was
back in the good days.
Yes, but there are studios and there are studios, right?
Right. Yeah. True. Yeah.
She was on Fox News Sunday, and they asked her if she knows more today about domestic and foreign affairs than she did 2 years ago, and she said, "Well, I hope so."
She's smart enough to do a little homework.
You know, she's actually dumber than Bush.
Oh, she really is. And so what she's saying is she really did know nothing.
Yeah, and Reagan wasn't very bright. Either. In fact, he began showing the signs of early Alzheimer's in his second term. So what is up with these Republicans that they like these people that aren't the sharpest? We don't want to call them retarded.
The sharpest knife in the drawer.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll get to that. She's all, she has a Down syndrome child. And she righteously for once was critical of the language that was used by Rahm Emanuel, who is the chief of staff for
Obama.
President Obama, and he said he wanted to run ads against conservative effing who are, how does he say that?
Let me find that.
Retarded.
Yeah.
Anyways,
yeah.
And she said she likened Emmanuel's slur on all God's children with cognitive and developmental disabilities to using the N-word, something she deemed unacceptable and heartbreaking.
And, you know, I have several African-American friends who I've talked to about this who have said, this is totally different. This is not the same at all. They were highly offended by her.
Well, let me say this: to have phrases like that about anyone diminishes their humanity.
For sure.
So, I mean, people that have cognitive disabilities now or developmental disabilities certainly aren't being lynched. I mean, once you level the N-word, then that so dehumanized people that you could the excuse to do anything to folks that that filled that category. Still, it words like that do hurt, and she is correct, and she should be. Sensitive to that. For instance, I know a family that has now, the young man is 23 years old, who has cognitive and developmental disabilities, and usually when people had that, they just sort of shunted them off into little workshops or turned them over to
homes,
institutions. This family, I could almost mention his name because this kid, I mean, I met him when he was in his teens and, you know, probably like 7 years ago. He goes around the country speaking about cognitive disabilities now. He can't read or write, but he can use a computer through all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see his ability for abstract thinking actually growing. I've seen that.
That's wonderful.
And you know why? Because everyone treats him like he's a full human being.
Yeah.
If you don't treat people like a full human being, they don't act like it.
Right. They won't grow.
Yeah. Some very, very courageous people will, but the majority of people often act out the script provided for them by the majority. And I'm not just talking racial either. I'm talking about poor people in general or racial deals and what have you. Although, in typical hypocritical style, there was old gas bag Limbaugh who used the same word. And they said, let's see, Governor Palin believes crude and demeaning name-calling at the expense of others is disrespectful. She didn't tell him to resign, didn't tell his company to fire him. She declined to say that Palin believes Limbaugh's statements were acceptable. She declined to say that Palin believes Limbaugh's statements were acceptable. What the hell does that mean? But anyways, she gave him a pass.
Oh, of course she did.
She gave him a pass.
Yeah, they're buds.
Yeah, back a little more to the teabaggers, right? So what are these people all about? I mean, they're about essentially angry white people who want to take our country back. It's not quite clear what they want. Do they want to take us back to George Bush?
Okay.
Or where?
Yeah, that's the question.
Ronald Reagan? I don't get it. Here.
Not too promising.
No. So they actually don't have a real program because it is just sort of a, what would you call it? Sort of a mass movement of psychopathology. There you go.
Yeah.
And it's people that are angry. I mean, you can really, you know, they say they're angry because there's been all this giveaway to the banks and the these big financial companies that got us in the mess in the first place, and everybody feels the same way.
They should have been angry about this all along with corporate welfare. Give me a break.
They never were angry when George Bush was giving away the store. They never were angry when Ronald Reagan and Bush 1 gave away the store. So there's a lot more to it, and they want a Ken and Barbie as sort of symbols or representation of what they think would make everything okay, uptight,
that,
all white.
It's very scary.
Yeah,
it really
it is. It is. But then they say, well, that's not true. You know, you just every time, you know, you're saying we're racist and we're stupid and we're, you know, psychopaths and...
Yeah, pretty much.
These are the kind
of people who join the Facebook group. This is the new one. They're for drug testing people who are on welfare. I kid you not, they become fans of this. I am so appalled. This is the kind of people who do that.
Who's on welfare anymore? There's hardly anybody on welfare. It's mothers and children, you know?
Yeah, and they should be drug tested.
Yeah, I think they should be drug tested.
That is sick.
But here, this is, let me see, what is this from? The teabaggers, who are they and what do they want? This is from Yahoo. The movement, in its essence, is about safeguarding individual liberty. Well, that's a nice thought. Anybody against that? All right. Cutting taxes. Hello, folks. That's what got us into the mess in the first place. One of the many things. One of the four things that got us into the mess in the first place. George Bush giving, use that same phrase, giving away the store to the ultra-wealthy, his buddies. See, these people don't realize this. These sort of fascistic movements, these right-wing movements, are carrying water for the ultra-rich. And they have this weird relationship always. And you go back into, like, European fascism. They both have this envy for the wealthy, you know, the middle class, and they also have this resentment towards them.
Right.
And fear.
Yeah. Fear. And if they're doing well, there's that mentality. If the wealthy are doing well, then they're going to do well. They should, you know, they need to keep that going for them.
And they're always, and they have this loathing of the classes beneath them or the races beneath them.
Oh,
so
yeah.
They're it's a real stew of psychoanalytic rage and fear and guilt and all of this. But so this article says, what do the teabaggers want? The movement in its essence is about safeguarding individual liberty. Okay, you know, who's against that? Cutting taxes. We should be raising taxes astronomically on the ultra-wealthy to the point where people start making over, I mean, come on, let's be real communistic about it, over 5 million. So somebody gets left with only 5 million a year. The rest, you know, should go out of where it came from, sort of the commonwealth, because ultimately we all are participants in creating wealth. Unless you believe, well, I'll get to that, you know, I'll get to that about, unless you believe all these people from, you know, these big financial firms like, you know, Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs. Yeah, if you think they should get millions and millions, okay. But that's not very teabagging. Ending bailouts for business while the American taxpayer gets burdened with more public debt. Well, this goes so far back that it's difficult. I mean, I can't imagine that there's too many people in this country and people listening that aren't just enraged at the fact what's happening to our neighbors, our neighborhoods, our communities, our city, our state, and seeing these Wall Street bankers just waltzing home with millions and millions of dollars more. So why are they talking about cutting taxes? You want to talk about cutting taxes on the middle class and below? I am all about that. And I always have been. If you listen for a long time, you know, I said we should have a $50,000 tax deduction. And that, in other words, that means if you make $55,000 a year, you pay tax on $5,000. That's it. So where are we going to, oh man, where are we going to get our money? From the people that got more than they could ever possibly spend. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where. And as long as we're in the shape that we are, there ought to be more sharing of the difficulties. But let's see if they got more stuff. Burdened with, well, there's nothing much we can do now. If there are people out there that think that there should have been what they called a market correction by allowing these banksters to just collapse, you're really willing to gamble, I'll tell you. It's like you start coughing up blood and start thinking, oh, you know, it's probably nothing. we were heading towards something bigger than the Great Depression, and the only thing that got us out were essentially the Bush bailouts. Remember, that's the Bush policies, A, that got us into it, and secondly, they began to realize that the only thing that was going to work was to bail out these guys. So once they're bailed out, here's the deal. Once they're bailed out, do we allow them to continue in the manner that they have been? Well, the Republicans want to protect the banksters, of course. So I don't know what these folks are about. There's a, oh yeah, they're trying to work up a platform. Here's a couple of 100,000 people have submitted ideas to the teabaggers. Drill here, drill now.
Oh
man, that's
back at that again.
Yeah,
huh?
Good idea, because all that oil that once it gets developed in 10 years will then get us gas for $2.49. Oh, that's what it was when I came in.
And don't these people know that there is oil that we produce that we export?
Yeah. A lot of that.
I think those people have no clue.
And they're always talking about the revolution. They got those revolutionary hats.
Oh, yeah. I'm all for revolution. It's a revolution of love.
There you go. Cue the Beatles. All
yeah,
you need
is. Right on.
Here's a really rad one. Abolish the Department of Education.
Ooh.
I'm not even sure why.
Why would they want to do that?
I have no idea. But
I mean, I understand that it's flawed.
Yeah. I mean, So they have nothing.
Just not educate anyone.
So they are in a froth about being in a froth, essentially.
These people probably don't sleep very well at night either.
No, and here, and you know, the idea was too that they had some. These were ordinary people that were suddenly moved to try to grasp exactly what we're saying, become engaged in
for a better America.
Yeah, right. But they've come up with nothing except Ken and Barbie. Well, the Ken of this all could turn out to be the newly elected Senator Scott Brown of the Republican of Massachusetts.
This is just getting worse all the time. Those two together, though, really perfect for each other.
Yeah, right. All he's got to do
is they'll end up having a torrid affair, doing methamphetamine, and having a big orgy.
What about the first dude, man? They'd have a brawl.
Oh, yeah.
They're both some hunk. They're both a couple of hunks, right?
Ew.
No? Come
first
on.
Dude? Ugh. Ick. No.
What about Scott Brown?
No. No.
You know what? You're letting your
No, those pretty
political...
boys. Those pretty boys are they're not to be trusted.
Have you ever seen Scott Brown's Playboy girl?
I did. On The View.
Yeah? Really?
Yeah.
They showed the... No.
Listen.
They didn't show it uncensored.
They did because his hands in front of his package. It's not that big of a deal.
Okay.
It was a long time ago, too. He looks a lot better.
Yeah. His election has been characterized by the son of the late Edward Kennedy, who Scott Brown replaced as a joke. Representative Patrick Kennedy, Democrat of Rhode Island, castigated Brown. Now, here's the deal. So Scott Brown said, I'm going to be a maverick. He didn't even use the word, fortunately. He said, I'm going to be an independent. So he was really pushing to be sworn in ahead of schedule to permanently fill the Senate seat left vacant by the congressman's father's death last August. So you think, why was he all about this? Well, what Representative Kennedy says, Brown's whole candidacy was shown to be a joke today when he was sworn in early in order to cast his first vote as an objection to Obama's appointment to the National Labor Relations Board. So essentially what they were trying to block is anyone or that Senator Brown was, anybody that would go to bat for the working people of this country. What they want is to fill it with center-rightist and far-right wingers, like the Supreme Court. And let's see here. They were trying to give Republicans enough to filibuster the nomination of Craig Becker, a controversial nominee to join the NLRB. Well, he's controversial because he supports the right of working people, not just union people, but working people. Kennedy said 7 out of 10 of Brown's voters were labor households, and he stressed that he was independent. And while he was originally scheduled to be sworn in next week, they moved it up today so he could cast his first vote, the most anti-labor, the most anti-what his constituents thought they were voting for when they voted for him. In other words, they got chumped. They got fooled.
Yeah, it's a racket.
Yeah. And Kennedy said, this is where he shows that when they need him, he's in the tank for the Republicans. Yeah. They asked the multimillionaire soccer mom, Sarah Palin. She said it would be absurd for her not to consider running for president in 2012.
I hope she does, because she's going down.
Who knows? How could George W. Bush...
And I know we don't like to put those two things together, but thinking Republicans... Don't like her.
All right. Don't, I think she's got like a 23% approval rate.
Bring her on.
But listen, don't let me forget that I was asking you whether you'd heard of the U.S. Social Forum, and I was purposely going on about the teabaggers because they had like 150 accredited reporters, although they were mostly giving it to right-wing news sources like
Fox News.
F-A-U-X.
Foxhole News. And there were only 500 people in attendance, right?
600.
600, okay.
And then 500 bought $350 tickets. Let me just say, I actually had this as part of something else, but there's four things that have sunk our economy. One was the deregulation that began under Ronald Reagan as Reaganomics. This was not just sort of episodic or we're going to do a little bit of deregulating. They actually believed this Milton Friedman Chicago School insane crap that if you allowed corporations to do whatever they wanted, they would actually create more wealth, more jobs, whatever. They actually did create more wealth, for themselves. This allowed more of the wealthy to accumulate even more wealth. So that's like four reasons. The second reason is impacted wealth. And rather than starting new businesses because there was really nothing to start and we were already losing industrial jobs and all that, they put it into the stock market to speculate. What a great idea.
Yeah.
And then they took all the regulations off of speculation, stock speculation. Clinton signed it. It was mostly Republicans, though, that wanted those bills. And the other things I mentioned before, tax cuts for the rich and these continuing wars. So if you put those things together, you have a disaster of an economy. And the idea that, the teabaggers also want fiscal responsibility.
Well, on whose part?
Well, on the government's part.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. The U.S. Social Forum. So let's go through this again. 600 people turned up in
Tennessee, yeah, Nashville.
Nashville, right. At the Grand Old Opry.
Or it's kind of a
Opry
place.
Land. Yeah, exactly. And although, you know, no sectional prejudice, please.
Sorry.
And another 500 paid $350 to hear the multimillionaire soccer mom talk. In Detroit, Michigan, a town some of you know that it has some problems, 15 to 20,000 people are going to assemble for the United States Social Forum between June 22nd and 26th. Of course, you've heard all of that.
All those socialists, Peter.
Yeah. Yeah. So the scope of the peace and social justice movement in this country is so much wider, staffed with so many more people than these teabaggers, and the media chooses what. Now, I'm not whining. I'm commenting because, you know what, this is, I don't expect anything from the media. These teabaggers like to say it's the liberal media. It has liberal aspects to it. You know, they, unlike the teabaggers, they think that there should be like social equality between races and genders and mm-hmm. sexual choices. So that does make them liberal as opposed to these people whose politics haven't changed since the 1950s. Right?
Poor people.
I mean, how do they live in this world?
Very uncomfortably.
I think so. Looking. Boy, what do they think about when they see a... never mind. I don't want to go.
Tell me during the break. I'm dying to know.
Yeah. But anyway, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E. And I meant to keep having the U.S. Social Forum link at the top. You go down a little. Or you can go to USSF2010. USSF2010.org. You can hook into this. This is going to be an incredible... wait a minute. I thought I had a piece from them. Oh, yeah. I signed up to be one of the writers for them. They have a U.S. Social Forum Writers Network. Then I'm not going to write anything. Why do I laugh?
What? Peter!
All right. It's part of a global movement for, they say, a global movement for justice is rising. That'll scare the hell out of them to begin with. And the USSF provides the opportunity to take part. It's open to everybody. It's not a conference. It is a process directed by its participants and attendees to build an inclusive, free, democratic, and international movement to transform the world. Ooh, I bet they don't like that. What is happening in Detroit and in Michigan is happening all around the country and all across the world. Detroit is ground zero for the U.S. economic crisis. And they write, what is the most disturbing about the media coverage of the teabaggers is that it denies the American public the ability to consider the full range of responses Americans have had to the economic crisis. While conservatives are promoting negative, defensive, and racist agendas, groups attending the U.S. Social Forum have more constructive answers to the serious economic challenges our country faces. And it says, for instance, Detroit is being held up by forum organizers as a solution city. And you go, ha, 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 ha. You just hear all just echoing through the Detroit suburbs. Ha, 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 ha. That's because you don't know anything about this. And this gives you the opportunity to, in fact, learn about it. And where alternative economic models, urban gardening, adaptive reuse, I don't know what that is, new educational models and visions for a truly sustainable green transportation industry are being born and developed by grassroots groups.
Yeah, have you seen the green taxis around Ferndale?
Oh, yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. So let me see. The forum process is helping these positive efforts by organizing to bring hundreds of bicyclists to Detroit. I mean, there's all sorts of things going on. Potentially purchasing a building for community groups, bringing a new library to the city, planting dozens of urban community gardens, and much more. And I'll tell you, folks in the USSF, you got to do much, much more than those three things. Those are all good, and those are things that bring small groups together. And I don't even know if we have to go for big policy items. I mean, the political process, because of the conservative activist radical right court deciding that corporations can enter the political field as individuals and contribute as much money as they want to candidates, they may have control the electoral politics now. So we're going to have to go outside of that. And usually people think, oh, we're going to have a demonstration, which are cool. I love a parade.
Yeah.
You know, you call a demonstration, Jelena be there.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. So, but ultimately, we've got to create, as it says, economic. I mean, how are we going to live in this world that where the rich are getting richer all the time? And you don't believe that? Well, let me do this because this takes us into the other part of things. So anyway, you got the teabaggers, 600, 1,100 of them. Let's give them the Palin, people that came to the Palin speech as well. 1,100 people. It gets half an hour of yak on night call. And and it's all over, you know, the biggest news. Sarah Palin assails Obama at Tea Party gathering. This is a headline I'm looking at. Who cares? I mean, why is she a big deal?
I don't get
she
it.
She was the governor of this teeny state who was a vice presidential candidate who didn't know anything, who was an embarrassment, who's stupidly and, you know, ignorant of everything one needs to know to function politically in the world, has barely gotten any better. She's a total media creation, and she assails Obama. Can you imagine the two of them having a debate?
Oh, yeah. Ugly.
And on the other hand,
but she seems to always somehow slide, you know, squeak through.
Well, she's so winsome.
She slimes through.
Yeah, yeah.
Ugh. You betcha.
You know, yeah. You know why she wears shoulder pads?
Oh, wow.
I don't know. You can't hear. That's visual. You would have had to see that.
I think a lot of people know that joke. I really do like your Sarah Palin imitation, though.
Yeah. Guys and gals, that's what I like, too. That's what she started at the Republican convention. Guys and gals.
Oh, I would be so offended.
A multimillionaire soccer mom.
Bimbo.
Yeah. Okay, and as I always say, if she would have looked like Margaret Thatcher, the ex-Prime Minister of England, no one would ever heard of her.
That's so true.
Yeah, it's Babel Rammer. It's Ken and Barbie. Okay, that's all I want to do. You can talk about her, but when we come back, I want to talk about maybe a little about religion. I always love to do that. And also talk more about money, honey.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Are you having trouble paying your credit card bills? You didn't expect to get so deep in debt, but now you need a way out, a way to relieve the anxiety, a way to avoid disaster. If you have over $12,000 in credit card debt, call Debt Settlement USA at 1-877-560-8877. Debt Settlement USA has a proven debt reduction program that can cut the amount you owe and get you out of debt faster than you could on your own. They've saved millions of dollars for their clients, and they can help you get back in control again, too. If your resolution is to get out of debt, call Debt Settlement USA for a free consultation. 1-877-560-8877. Your call is confidential, and there's no obligation. If you have over $12,000 in credit card bills, they can cut the amount you owe and help you get out of debt. Call Debt Settlement USA right now. 1-877-560-8877. That's 1-877-560-8877.
Do you want a wireless laptop but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronix is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
Verizon Wireless is the best destination for affordable, unlimited calling. And that's good to know, because you don't have unlimited funds. Is there a money tree in your garage? Or a goose laying golden eggs? Doubtful. And while you may find the end of the rainbow, you will likely not find a pot of gold. Yes, the hard truth is, you earn your money and want to spend it wisely. That's why Verizon Wireless gives you unlimited calling, now for less. $30 less than ever before. It's only $69.99 monthly access. Yes, get unlimited talk on America's largest and most reliable wireless network to any number in the U.S., even landlines, for a new lower price. And that's good, because sadly, buried treasure is only in pirate movies. To get our best value ever on unlimited calling, go to VerizonWireless.com/new, Verizon Wireless, or call 1-800 to join in. Activation, early termination, and other fees apply. Coverage details at VerizonWireless.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to another segment. Join us, 313-298-WRIF. I was noting, not even complaining. I don't expect anything from the mainstream media. 1,100 teabaggers are all over the media. 20,000 people coming into Detroit June 22nd to 26th for the U.S. Social Forum. You say, hey, man, come on. There's snow on the ground still. You know, we'll be in our flip-flops when the Social Forum happens. Give them a little time to gear up. I'm telling you, they won't happen. I'll bet you that the news and the free press will do stuff on it.
I believe so, yeah.
But it won't get national
stuff. No.
I want to talk more about the economy, but a couple of people have been waiting a long time. Let's go to hell. Here's Kim. He's in Hell, Michigan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a comment from way back in the beginning of the show about the term retarded.
Yeah, when Sarah Palin was complaining about Rahm Emanuel from Obama's office, but didn't complain about Rush Limbaugh.
Well, I work in a group home, and we have 6 developmentally disabled clients. Now, their current medical records state that their Axis 1 diagnosis is either severe or profound mental retardation.
Yeah, that's the old. You know what? My wife used to work for, what was it called? Something or other for retarded citizens.
Yeah.
I mean, names change over the years and what's attached to them. You know, I mean, sometimes when you hear this stuff, did you ever see in the 1920s there was on these old movies, silent movies, there was a comedian named Fatty Arbuckle?
Oh, sure.
And they laugh and they say now he would be called weight-challenged Arbuckle. Right? Because, we don't want to make derogatory names. And also, how people identify themselves. If you think about the way African-American people went from, colored to Negro to black to African-American. And they all came about at different particular times and connoted different social circumstances. But in the case of this, Michigan Association of Retarded Citizens, that's what mm-hmm. it was. And the last word, the citizen, was on there with an attempt to say, these people are inclusive.
Yeah.
And I think, though, that the idea that I forgot what the language was.
On which? By who?
What do we call that? Hold on here. It's here. I can't find it. But anyway, it's here it is. I don't know if they use the word challenged or not. Why can't I find this? developmentally or... Oh, yeah.
Developmentally disabled, didn't they say?
Cognitive and developmental disabilities.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, some people don't even like that. I mean, I've heard people, like, they don't want to be called disabled.
Yeah.
They want to be called differently able.
Abled, absolutely.
You know, and it sounds clunky. You know?
I like it, though. It works. I go to a festival every summer, a big music festival, and that's what they use.
Well, you know, these are people, here's what I'm saying, is that there is a lot of, oftentimes discrimination against people that have disabilities or are differently abled. And those, if they say, hey, I want to be known as, and I think a certain phrase or a certain word or group of words diminishes me as a human being and a fully included citizen, I don't care how clunky it is. I mean, it's a lot easier to call somebody Fatty Arbuckle than Weight Challenge. Arbuckle, right?
All right, well, it has more of a ring
Thank
to
you
it.
Very
I
much.
Hate to say it, but we got an email from Joe, and I remember this. You weren't aware of this, but Levi, who had, is it?
He was the father.
Yeah, Bristol's baby.
Yeah.
Trip or Twig or whatever.
Twist.
Yeah, exactly. So Levi, and he was quoted in a magazine article saying that Sarah Palin called her baby retarded quite often, and that once she asked an aide at a rally to hand her one of her children, and when the aide made a movement towards one of her quote-unquote normal children, she was quick to say no, the retarded one, because she felt she could garner more sympathy with that child on stage. I read that, too. I actually saw him in an interview, but let's not listen to Levi.
I love Levi.
I like him, too.
Was it his mother? Was it his mother that got busted for drugs? Yeah.
Yeah, she had some OxyContin problems or something like that.
She was. Well, their problem was she was selling it.
Right, yeah.
She was selling it to Rush Limbaugh when he was addicted
no.
to it?
No.
No.
Right. He had all kinds of avenues. He didn't need her.
He did. Let's see. Here is Kevin in Detroit. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
How you guys doing?
We're doing good.
All right. I kind of agree with something what Jolene said. Pete, it's not out of the realm of possibility that this woman could be elected president of this country.
I agree.
And this political climate in this country. Now, I'm a black guy, and I've been listening to you for 25 years.
Who?
And since 1985. And I would love to went down there when you went to that King celebration, maybe sometime in the future, because I've always enjoyed your talk show for, like I said, since 1985. But my thing of it is this. How can she equate what she said, the N-word and all this other stuff? This woman will say anything.
Yeah.
She'll say anything. I mean, and let me ask you both.
Sure.
What do you think basically the tea baggers are basically made up of? Do you think a lot of that is fueled by race?
Well, I think I do. Yeah, and so do I. And I think these are probably 90% people that were always far right wing anyway, and they've just mobilized around because you know they didn't come out in when those bailouts first began. I think it was like in November of 08, and Bush put those things in. But it was their world is beginning to crack and they see, sure, without even, you know, I mean, it's not like they're these old-fashioned segregationists of the 1940s or 1950s. The guy that was leading what was called the Teabag Express, this bus that was going around, was an African-American guy. So,
Well, they got a parade one now and there here to show that. Because, after all, their love for Rovio, whatever his name in Florida, to win a Senate race down there. Because then they can say, see, we got Michael Steele and we got him. So that proves we're not racist. That proves that right there. Like Ronald Reagan said many years ago that he let one use the phone before. You know, he said that many years ago.
Now, well, Ronald Reagan also sold a house with what's called a racial covenant that said on it that could only be sold to a white Christian.
Did he really?
Yeah. And, yeah, there is this long-standing process. And, it used to be called, and, I mean, I hope it, and if you know what it means, I hope it doesn't offend you, as NUF. Do you know that one from way back?
I think my mother mentioned that.
Yeah. Well, that is
exactly what you said. I hear that John Kennedy had a covenant in his property, too. He had some in his was also.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me. I mean, that was not unusual. I mean, maybe to some extent, going back into those days. But I don't know. You know, I keep hearing these right-wingers. They keep just talking about... I was going to say, what's his name? Not Donald Byrd. He plays trumpet. What's the guy from...
Robert Bird.
Robert Bird, thank you. Being the Ku Klux Klan, and so, you know.
Yeah, but I can see her, I think Jolene touched on it earlier, I can see her in the political climate, because let's be honest, I think the Republican Party, especially, has scared a lot of elderly whites that this guy, you better look at him, he may change the social order in this country, he may take away your health care and give it to those people, I'm serious.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of them think that way.
Oh, yeah, and you know what, I was hanging out with one of my black friends last night, and I was telling her about this whole Facebook, these people becoming fans of drug testing for welfare. And she looked at me and she goes, you know, they might as well just say black people. You know?
That's what she said.
Yeah.
Wow.
She did.
All right. Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate your call.
Kevin.
Thanks for listening for
25
so
years,
long.
Kid.
Yeah. Wow. So, geez. So, I was 16 then. here's Dominic and Taylor. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was calling about something you guys mentioned, it was at the beginning about drug testing people on welfare.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've been down in Detroit lately, but I work in Detroit every night, and I've seen it with my own eyes where I've walked into a gas station, there's a guy that buys, like, unprepared food with his bridge card.
What's unprepared food?
Well, like pizza rolls and stuff like that, you can't put it in the microwave. You can't, if it's microwaved, they can't buy it on their bridge card. It's prepared food. Like, you can't buy a sandwich.
Right, okay. And so somebody buys unprepared food and?
Okay, and then he pays with his bridge card for that. Like, this guy was in front of me. I saw it happen. He bought it on his bridge card, grabs it in his pocket, pulls out a wad. It had to have been at least $1,000 in 20s. Buy a $5 blunt wrap that came with like three or four of them, and when he walked out to the car, he was driving a brand new Cadillac Escalade with huge rims.
It was a welfare queen, I thought of. This is a welfare king. But what does this tell you? I've heard these stories before, but so what does this tell you, Dominic?
I just know that I work.
What percentage do you think
is
fraud?
Everyone does that?
I mean, you know how long, I mean, I'm not even saying this doesn't happen. By the way, I used to be an investigator before, you know, when I actually did honest work. I used to be, you know, before I got into radio, that I used to be an investigator for the old Detroit Welfare Department, which my job was to investigate fraud. And lo and behold, guess what? There were actually people on welfare that were cheating. I mean, I was shocked. I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, people in poor neighborhoods actually trying to rip off the system for, you know, a few bucks. So, but to expand that, I mean, you know, everybody, the idea that somehow all of us white suburbanites are being ripped off by these colored welfare cheats just doesn't even approach the subject. What Julian mentioned earlier, corporate welfare. I mean, the corporations of this country were able to grow and enrich themselves and continue to do so by our tax dollars. That would mean if every single person left on welfare was cheating, every single person, that it would be a pittance compared to what the corporations
worried about the guy and his prepared food and his lot of money.
Yeah,
you really don't know his
right,
story. You don't know if that was his car or if he was working for someone else either. I mean, let's not judge.
Let's say he's a scamster. I don't even know.
Well, I could care less.
Yeah. Well,
personally,
I don't think. No, I do. I don't think people should, rip people up. But here.
I just know that that's going to happen. But,
But that comes from a place. I mean, part of it is frustration. But what it is, and I'm not talking about you, Dominic, and I wish I could say this word, but it's what I call a psychoanalytic chicken poop. But, you know, they use the normal.
Okay.
That is that people, when they feel squeezed economically, when the social and economic system begins to rumble under their feet, rather than turning to their betters, their masters, the rulers, they turn on the poor beneath them.
Yeah.
And that's not where your problems are coming from. If you ended all handouts to the poor, as you know they're called, there wouldn't be a bit of difference in anyone's system. But here's what's happening. Where's this from? The Information Clearinghouse. If there's any indicator, the toll that the Great Recession has taken on the public would be the statistics beginning to emerge about hunger in the U.S. According to a study from the nation's largest food bank operator, the number of Americans in need of food aid has jumped 46% in 3 years, including a 50% jump in the number of children needing food assistance and a 64% increase in hunger in senior citizens' homes. Now, I mean, the story, Dominic, does none of us any good. Let's say it's 100% correct. I don't know. You know, they've actually found out that it's cheaper to let a few people scam than to have investigators like I did.
Really?
And have people come in and have to make statements and all that. Because they get like a 3%, 4% fraud rate on all of this. And if they can have investigators and they drive it down to 1.5%, in the meantime, they got to pay all these people to do it. So there is a certain amount of fraud. You know what's really a fraud level about that? Doctors milking Medicare.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, these are, you know, upscale white guys usually doing this. And people usually don't complain about them too much. The study called Hunger in America 2010 found that 37 million people, or roughly 1 in 8 U.S. residents, received food aid in 2009. That's a 46% jump from a similar survey carried out in 2006. Thank you, George Bush.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. We could have predicted this during those 8 years. And we knew that we didn't really know exactly how big it was going to be, but we knew it was going to be a large number.
Also, this from the New York Times, the number of Americans getting help from soup kitchens, shelters, and food pantries each week rose 27% in the past 4 years to 5.7 million people, according to a survey by Feeding America. It's another group. So, I mean, that's what I mean. The anecdotal story does us no good whatsoever, because what that essentially means is that you have to just, ignore those people that are in genuine need. But in the meantime, the fourth quarter, ExxonMobil's profit dropped 23%.
Oh,
they only made $6.5 billion.
Oh, poor babies.
But they were buying. They bought XTO Energy for $31 billion, stuff like that.
Oh,
they gained a major foothold in Iraq.
Iraq. Well, another thing we predicted during those 8 years.
This
Peter,
wasn't a war for oil. People said, how dare you say that was a war for oil?
Well they're buying up all the oil.
Yeah.
And, let's talk about that today. You know, people forget.
Every week on my website, peterwerbe.com. Okay, I'll spell it. W-E-R-B-E.
Do it.
It lists. I mean, this is such a... I can't begin to tell you how I feel. I have to update it. How many Americans have lost their lives? I mean, we never. There's no list for the Americans or the Afghans that have lost their lives, but there was not a single U.S. soldier killed in Iraq this week.
This week.
This week. Yeah, it's very unusual. There's usually one or two. Here's another.
I'm still not encouraged.
Yeah. Here's. The idea the recession is over, although I would say this is probably causing the recession. Humana, the health insurer, posted a 44% increase in fourth quarter profits.
Life is good for them.
So those of you, pardon me, who do not want a cap on private insurers, that's one of the things that the teabaggers don't want. They don't want any public option. They don't want any, national health care. This is what goes on. The increases go on and on and on. But here's also what's going on. Angie Newby went back to work in September, but she still has not escaped the burden imposed by 9 months of unemployment. Ms. Newby and her husband were forced to walk away from their home in suburban Detroit and are now living here in a rented house in Raleigh, North Carolina with their three children. They're bracing for a huge tax bill in the spring because of early withdrawals that she made on her 401k and taxes they still owe on unemployment benefits. Their credit is in tatters, and this is what happens. Their 16-year marriage showed cracks they are still trying to repair. Pardon me. The wound of unemployment, as her family has learned, has not cauterized so quickly, is not healed, and lives do not simply go back the way they were.
She goes on to say that she much is never, her family will never recover from this.
Yeah.
You know, and boy, a lot of people can relate to that.
Here's the New York Times Business Day section for Saturday. John G. Stumpf, Wells Fargo CEO is making $18.4 million for his 2009 compensation.
You know, we read about this and we read it, but nothing changes.
I do.
They report it and no one does, I don't know, nothing changes.
So, Angie Newby, working her butt off. John G. Stump and Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan Chase and Lloyd C. Blankfein from Goldman Sachs and James P. Gorman from Morgan Stanley and Brian T. Moynihan for the Bank of America, who caused this woman to lose her job, to almost have her marriage break up. They're being rewarded from $35, $54, $62, $68 million, if I can do the addition quickly.
Playing a lot of golf, eating a lot of lobster, smoking
between
Cubans.
Six guys. Jeez. Now, if we're going to go the commie route, which I'm all for, it means we would keep their salaries down to like $2 million or something like that.
Yeah. You know,
as long
How dare
as
you, Peter.
As long as it's their money. That's what, you know, these
they earned it. No, not really.
Yeah, you know, that's what even working class guys from some of our working class suburbs would call up, and their voice would be shaking at me. It's their money. How dare you try to take it away from them? Well, you don't hear from them anymore because we realize now that they always did, but it's even more evident now, they took it all away from us. If they hadn't have taken it from us in these bailouts, they would be in the unemployment line themselves. And instead of making $18.4 million for 2009, old John G. Stump, well, his name is spelled S-T-U-M-P-F, yeah. A good German name, I'm not trying to make fun of it. Verba, that's my name.
Right, yeah.
That he would be on the unemployment line. He might have to be going to North Carolina to start a new job and wondering where it was all going to come from.
Yeah, well, these guys always end up on their feet smelling like roses.
Yeah. We just got a minute or two left here. This is from Carlo. Carlo is listening in Brisbane in Queensland State in Australia. And he says, I'd like to get your thoughts on American wages and standard of living as compared to down here in Australia, the rest of the world. Actually, he's from Windsor, where he used to listen, but
okay.
He moved to Australia. I find it so unfair that people have to work for minimum wage. Who the hell, he asks, can live on $7 or $8 an hour or less? In Australia, you get a living wage. A person over the age of 21 makes $18 to $19 an hour.
Yeah.
And you can't change that. And if you try, meaning like a business, the government will smack you down with huge fines. He says, I get 4 weeks off a year plus paid holidays. Shift workers get 5 to 6 plus paid holidays. I have health care, which comes out of my taxes. I have a work week of 38 hours. After that is overtime and a half, and he can refuse it. A woman or man can have up to 12 months unpaid maternity leave. I get to retire at 55 years of age, and I have a pension that my employers must pay. This is all in Australia.
Enviable, for sure.
Yes. We didn't get hit by the market crash, folks. Here in Australia, Carlo is saying we didn't get hit by the market crash because we have laws that forbid predator-type lending, so we still have our jobs and our homes. Ronald Reagan began all this. It's Reaganomics. It's what the Republicans stand for. Bill Clinton didn't do a damn thing. George Bush pushed it with a vengeance, and Barack Obama is not doing a thing about it. Even you teabaggers ought to know that you got to turn on these people that have caused it all, and not just these, I don't know, what are they? We want smaller government. Well, what the hell? He says, we still have people driving Ferraris. They own multiple homes all over the world, and we still have millionaires and billionaires. I mean, because even in what people call socialist governments, like in Sweden and all that, it's run by rich people. But he says, this is a long thing. He's working as a recording and mix engineer.
Really?
Yeah. The guy that he works for, he says, I can't put it better than a man from New York that I work with, that does own the studio. He says, Americans will soon be the ones leaving their country in pursuit of a better life for them and their families, where before people used to leave to come to America.
Peter, you ready to go?
Thanks, Peter and Jalene. I really enjoy your show. Well, thank you, Carlo, down under. I'm here for the duration.
Okay. All right.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
All this weekend on RF.
It's your Drew and Mike favorites, just in time for the big game. Keep it locked on 101 WRIF for the best of Drew and Mike Weekend Big Game Edition, with some of the biggest and best big game guests, interviews, and surprise hotel room phone calls of all time. We're talking gushers with gridiron greatness like you won't hear anywhere else. The best of Drew and Mike Weekend Big Game Edition, exclusively from 101 WRIF.
Ready?
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that now it's more important than ever to buy an American-made vehicle. We at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing and want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new Lincoln MKS, the sleek Lincoln MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the Lincoln MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. We encourage you to check out our virtual showroom on our website, Demmer.com. You can check out our vehicle inventory, and you can bet that if we don't have the vehicle you're in the market for, we'll do our very best to get it for you. While you're online, we invite you to get a no-obligation internet price quote. Whether you come into our newly renovated dealership or visit us online, we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury invite you to experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com.
It's another new year, and your debt is higher than ever. Credit card balances that keep growing. Rising medical bills. Maybe you lost your job, or you're afraid of losing your home. That's the bad news. But you can work through your debt problems with help from Credit Card Relief. No, we're not a consolidation loan, not another one of those credit counseling deals, and not bankruptcy. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. If you're struggling with too much credit card debt, call us for a free consultation. We have an outstanding record of performance helping people get out of debt in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars. Call Credit Card Relief right now. The consultation is free and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julian Jordan.
The rich, out of the palace, into the ditch. You see all those teabagging revolutionaries where they would do that. I don't think so, because really they're not radical, they're not revolutionaries, they're just would like to...
Repulsive.
You know who's going to join me in a pre-recorded interview? How can you have a... What is pre-recorded? Before recorded.
It's recorded.
A recorded interview. Dennis Coffey, who's a legendary session man with Motown. He's plays around town a lot. He was written an incredible book, Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars. So he's going to be talking about his long career in the entertainment industry.
Oh, nice.
That's at 1 a.m., so about 1 hour from now. Craig Hoffman, government affairs lobbyist for Public Citizen, talking about the impact on elections that is going to result from the far-right-wing activists' Supreme Court's decision to recognize corporations as persons that can donate unlimited funds to candidates. And actually, let me see, somewhere or other I had here, I don't know, I thought I had, oh yeah, from Ryan in Westland. He says, with the new Supreme Court decision, what's to stop former CEOs of Philip Morris or Goldman Sachs from running for Congress and being elected? What that means, essentially, they're recognized as having the same rights as people. And he's, do you think Senator Pfizer is going to enact laws that to favor the people, or President Walmart is going to promote fair work conditions in the third world? This Supreme Court decision terrifies me. Well, it should, yeah. Ryan. And the interview that I am going to run, I think second, so that'll be at 1:30, is going to be exactly about that. And I think the website, yeah, is don'tgetrolled.org. Don'tgetrolled.org, or you can go to citizen.org. Yeah. So now the money is, what's that Bob Dylan line? Money doesn't talk, it swears.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's always been corporate dominated, but now they don't even make any, you know.
Yeah. John from Troy wrote in, and we were talking about a couple of things. The use of the word retarded by Rahm Emanuel, Sarah Palin going after him, and Rush Limbaugh, the whole story. John says, my brother-in-law has a child with Down syndrome, and they belong to the ARC, the Association for Retarded Children, and they have a chapter in every state, so that still does exist.
I guess it still does exist, yeah. So maybe it was a much, Rahm Emanuel, the presidential advisor, apologized for saying, I guess maybe it's one thing.
This word, like, is a big part of our culture. I hate to say it. People use it that way. That's so retarded. I hear people all the time use it.
People call people tards and stuff like that.
It's, you know,
well, maybe one
it's
thing.
It's just that they're in the public eye.
To use it as an epithet.
Right. Exactly.
Like that. Well, Rahm Emanuel should have apologized, as he did. And but what about Rush Limbaugh that used it, and Sarah Palin let him off the hook?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Suspect. He also says the opening speaker of the Baggers rally started off by making a racist remark that people who can't speak English or even know how to spell the word vote shouldn't be allowed to vote. And he was referring to the literacy test the Republicans had in place back in the old days.
Well, it wasn't Republicans. In fairness, it was the Democrats. That one of the ways that they carried out segregation, restricting the vote to white people, the way it was. I mean, maybe there's strict constitutionalists. That's the way it was in the original Constitution. You know, you had to be white, propertied male in order to vote.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, they had literacy tests that, and even, I mean, there were in the South in like the 40s and the 50s when a black citizen had the temerity to attempt to vote, and they would give him the literacy test, and college graduates, couldn't pass it. I mean, of course, black people were denied a decent education, and oftentimes they, who's a senator from Montana? You know, here's a Mississippi sharecropper, right? But they would actually they would ask questions so complex that that black college graduates eventually, because they could keep ramping it up.
Yeah.
You know, what's pi to the 14th digit?
Right. Oh my gosh. Right. That's awful.
This one isn't signed, but it was sent into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. You think China will hire any out of work U.S. labor? Yeah, maybe at Walmart shops or something like that. All right. Oh yeah. we got to get this in though. This is the Department of What Was She Thinking? Remember old Mark Sanford who went hiking on the Appalachian Trail?
Yeah. Then he was, quote unquote, allegedly.
He was down seeing Maria Belen Shapur, his soulmate.
Yeah.
Well, apparently South Carolina's first lady, who was the wife of, or is the wife still of, Governor Mark Sanford, who famously cheated on her, estranged with a woman he described as a soulmate, did not want to. When they got married, the governor didn't, well, he wasn't a governor then, he did not want to include a vow of fidelity in their marriage ceremony.
Not only did he not want to include it, he didn't. He had it struck out of the record, so to speak.
What is the line you probably, and you go, I don't think so.
I mean, really?
These people, what a schmuck.
Oh, awful.
Yeah. And then, let's see, one email from the governor. Wait a minute, where is this? He said that her children were devastated by the emails. And at one point, why don't we have this music? One email from a governor to his Argentine lover said, I could digress and say you have the ability to give magnificent gentle kisses, or that I love your tan lines, or that I love the curve of your hips, the erotic beauty of you holding yourself, or two magnificent parts of yourself.
this guy.
In the faded glow of the night's light.
Did he really write this? Oh, yeah. I could throw up.
But how about in the faded glow of the night's light? But hey, that would be going into sexual detail.
Yeah, right.
What was he thinking? What she said somewhere.
Peter, his big brain wasn't thinking.
No, it just slipped down into his wee-wee.
Yes.
But where,
it happens.
Where does he say, she says somewhere or other, you know, finally he said, why didn't he just shut up?
Yeah, for real. Just zip it, Sanford.
Anyway, another thing that the teabaggers want, they don't like a big debt, that we're heavily in debt, going even deeper into debt. There's a lot of...
they shouldn't have enjoyed those 8 years with Bush then.
Yeah, that's what sent us down there. They should have been on the line of every huge picket line. I mean, we had in some cases like a million people out, at, like in New York and Washington, and they could have swelled it with another million. In fact, if they were these right-wingers and the base that they were and are of right-wing politicals like George Bush, he probably wouldn't have carried out this war in Iraq. But they just, they were banging the war drums. Now, the teabaggers claim they care about deficits, but they want to cut taxes. How are you going to pay that off? By cutting taxes. We'll shrink government. Well, I got to tell you, the wars and the cut in taxes goes up into the trillions to the point there wouldn't be a deficit if it wouldn't have been for the tax cuts and for these continuing wars. And let's see, where is all this? Oh, yeah. The projected deficit in the coming years, nearly 11% of the country's entire economic output, is not unprecedented. During the Civil War, World War I, and World War II, the United States ran soaring deficits. Oh, hello. What did I almost say? Ran soaring deficits, but it's appropriate. Slip.
Yeah.
But usually with the expectation that they would come back down once peace was restored and war spending abated. Well, here is the problem. We have a military-industrial complex that is at the center of our industrial production. So it's never going to come down. In fact, it's going to go up. And that's what Obama did. And that's what George Bush did. And that's what Bill Clinton did. And that's what Ronald Reagan did. It goes up and up and up. Well, there's no way that this is ever going to come down to what it should be. Some Nobel Prize-winning Paul Krugman writes in the New York Times. He says, that there's no, he doesn't think there's any real worry about deficits. It's not good, he says, but the point is that running big deficits in the face of the worst economic slump since the 1930s is actually the right thing to do. If anything, deficits should be bigger than they are because the government should be doing more to create jobs. Not to bail out any more banksters, but to create jobs. And I don't understand, too, why they're not confiscating more money from these banks. Canada's experience does not support the views that that Poo placed much of the blame for the crisis on the... Oh, I'm sorry. It places much of the blame for the crisis on the failure to protect consumers from deceptive lending. I mean, that was one of the things that created the housing
crisis. Oh, yeah.
But as I read last week from the Left Business Observer, that if you cut these wars, two things. Let me see. We're in here. Over the next decade, the Congressional Budget Office projects that we, and that's the right pronoun there, we will spend $7.5 trillion on the military. Now, who are we facing militarily? Guys that put bombs in their underwear,
right?
Guys that hijack planes with box cutters. And we're going to spend $7.5 trillion roaming all around the world. Where is that that one? Just I like the headline.
What, Pakistan?
You take your pick. But here, no, this. U.S. raises stakes on Iran by sending in ships and missiles. Aren't we a little far from home? Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't get it, because we want to protect the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, right? You don't want to let them get bombed by some missile, because you never can tell. You know, President Ahmadinejad might just say, I got an idea. Let's bomb Dubai. Why? I don't know. I just want to do it.
They have tall buildings.
Yeah, they have tall buildings. Their building is too tall. So we would save, I don't think we'd ever cut it in half, but we're spending $7.5 trillion on military, probably about $6.5 trillion more than we even in a reason, any reasonable level we should do. And then also in the left business observers is taxing the rich, that if you raised taxes on the top 5%, so that's 95% of us don't get any tax raise whatsoever, would yield another $150 billion or so. And if you squeeze those just below them by another 3 points, you get over $200 billion. Adjust that tax bite for inflation and economic growth, and you've got another $2.5 trillion over the next 10 decades. So we substantially reduce the military budget, except the teabaggers don't want to do that, and raise the taxes on the rich substantially, and you've got $10 trillion. Hello? I guess we're out of the woods. But the teabaggers go, oh, no.
No, my idea is sell the Vatican. Feed the world.
What? We don't own that.
Well, I'm just saying they should do it.
Okay. That would be nice.
Yeah.
Let's see. Actually, oh, yeah. Some people on the phone here. 313-298-WRIF. Oh, we didn't tell people that one of the reasons I'm yakking my head off and not giving you guys much of a chance, I'm not going to be here next week. I'm going off on a little vacay.
Leaving me.
And leaving you. So be you and Jolene, my partner in thought crime. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always fun.
Okay, and I might not be back the Sunday after.
Peter, you will be back.
I'm going to try. I mean, if all the trains and planes and cars are...
I'll have my fingers crossed 2 weeks in a row without you. Yeah. Almost more than I can bear.
Right. Here's John on the east side of Detroit. John, hi, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for being so patient.
Good morning, Peter, Jolene.
Hi.
Hi.
So refreshing your show is.
Well, thank you.
And I've been listening for more years than I care to
share.
Divulge.
Yeah.
Anyway, two things. One's about the welfare. I actually happen to collect food stamps first time. I'm 46 years old, and I live on the east side of Detroit. And I'm also a community leader here. And we're trying to get some grocery stores here in the city of Detroit because we have a real issue buying groceries here in the city.
Sure.
And one of the things we found is that 90% of all EBT cards issued to Detroit residents are spent outside the city of Detroit.
Wow. Those are the so-called bridge cards, the ones that are allow you to buy the food stamps.
Yeah, they're the electronic food stamps.
Right.
Over 90%, 93% of all food stamps issued in the city of Detroit are spent outside of the Detroit. So these people that say they see this at gas stations and all that, they only see like a real small percentage of all the food stamps.
Exactly.
So, and perception is, you know, whatever.
Well, then people just go and judge every single person and just lump everyone together. So upsetting.
The other thing about it is that not only Michigan but nationwide, if you looked at the people that were collecting assistance, a very small amount of them are African Americans.
Yeah.
You take some of the northern counties in Michigan alone. Marquette
sure.
County is one of the poorest counties. Up where my parents retired in Mason County, it's just like, you know, it's always been poor. And so if you really looked at the racial breakup of people that are on assistance, there's a really small portion of it that's African American. So it's just amazing to listen to some of the drivel.
Well, and as I was saying, what it's all about is the refusal to look look in the direction from which the misery emanates, and it's not from poor people. It's not from the few, very very few people that are taking advantage of the system. It's the very very wealthy people that run the system so they can take advantage of it. But thank you, John. And you know, did you hear me talking about the United States Social Forum? Are you with me? Yeah. Did you hear me talking about that?
No, I just got off of work. I was downtown.
Okay.
But could I comment on one other thing before I go?
Wait 1 second.
Okay.
You should. Do you use a computer?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Have you ever been to my website?
No, I haven't.
Okay. It's Peter Werbe. My last name is Werbe.com.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go down a little, there's something called the United States Social Forum. It's going to be here on, it's going to take place in Detroit.
Oh, yeah, in June.
June 22nd to
yep.
June 26th. Yep. It's definitely the kind of stuff that they'd like to hook up with you with, because, you know, there's a whole urban food movement, including down at the Eastern Market. They have, grown in Detroit, grown inside the boundaries of Detroit. Hey, I was buying Detroit. I was drinking this, I'll give it a plug by name, Valentine Vodka.
Made, oh, yeah.
Made in Detroit.
Was it good?
Oh, man. It was very good. Listen, let me move on, though, John, and you can talk about the other issue another day. I appreciate your call. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Let's see here. Sean in Monroe. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
I just wanted to comment real quick. I thought it was kind of funny. Jalene, you just said, talking to this the guy that just got off the phone, how everybody shouldn't be lumped together.
Yeah.
And Peter, you said earlier how everybody's making the welfare thing a racial thing. Well, Dominic from, I think he said he was from Detroit, they called a couple callers ago. He never mentioned once that he was a black guy, and you guys just assumed that he was.
What do you think?
What do you mean, what do I think?
I don't...
He said inner city.
I did not even think that once.
Oh, I did. As soon as I hear Cadillac, I mean, that's the old... I mean, that was the Ronald Reagan little deal, the welfare queen. He never said black.
I didn't even think about that.
And when people used to say the other thing, I see people driving up to welfare offices in their Cadillacs. I mean, that's when, you know, a number of years ago, they never said black. Who do you think they meant?
You said black after he said...
I know, I know. Listen, there's... The people don't speak the way they used to 50 and 60 years ago. You got to speak a little by indirection, because at least we've gotten to the point in our lives where overt statements of racism is totally unacceptable. So you have to find ways to get around that. But when you say... Inner city gas station, guy with a big roll. Yeah, could it be a white guy?
Could have
been a white guy? Yeah, I doubt it. Dominic can probably call and tell us whether that's the case or not. But I assume that's the case.
I don't think assuming is a good idea. Really?
Well, I took that as what those stories are all about.
Right, right. I hear what you're saying,
Yeah, right. I mean, you're right. Let me go. Here's Terrence in Hazel Park. Hi, Terrence. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter and Jalene. Always enjoy listening to you.
Thank you.
One thing I've got to ask you is, you keep saying teabaggers, teabaggers. And the teabaggers might be one thing, but the tea partiers are not Sarah Palin and the Republican Party. The tea partiers are the people that are really... fighting for liberty and trying to find ways to get the liars and thieves out of office.
How are they fighting for individual liberty?
Well, it's like Bob Schultz of We the People Foundation is suing the federal government for bailing out AIG and violating the Constitution in the process of doing all the bailouts.
Well, that's good, but I mean, that doesn't have anything to do with individual liberty. I mean, everybody, I mean, mention to the Tea Party or Tea Baggers, say ACLU, who is founded on the principle of individual liberty, protecting the individual citizen from the perniciousness of government, and they will go into a froth. ACLU, you know, like that.
Well, a communist foundation organization is like the ACLU is. They would.
Communist? Did you just go?
The true constitutionalists would argue that that's what they are. And that's
we got it.
Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
But I'm just asking you not to, or to at least clarify or define what you mean by teabaggers.
We're gonna stick with teabaggers.
Yeah, sorry. I like teabaggers. Yeah, and I think you just gave it all away when you're talking about the ACLU. Anyway,
yeah,
all right, so thanks, Terrence.
Yes.
Yeah,
that was,
I mean,
transparency at its finest.
You know, libertarians, that really are worried about the about government encroachment on individual liberties. And by the way, did any one of those teabaggers complain when George W. Bush violated the Constitution? By the way, I don't care that anybody's suing the government, and I don't know what the remedy is for having given this money to these banksters to stop the system from collapse that George Bush began. But did any of them ever complain when George Bush broke every law in the book, illegally wiretapping people, lying about the entrance into the Iraq war? I'm forgetting all of this stuff. There used to be a site called a thousand reasons, essentially a thousand reasons to impeach George W. Bush. And they were very, very specific. And the site, which had a thousand reasons, and then went on to like 12 or 1300 different incidences, there wasn't one peep out of the creatures from the Black Lagoon, you know, from the right wing.
Yeah.
They were just all okay. Yeah.
Well,
torture people, you want torture people? Sure!
Which is surprising because the Ron Paul people, Ron Paul, let's just speak for him, because we can, because he said it, he wants to close down all the bases all over the world. So.
And he was opposed to torture, yeah.
Contradicting.
Yeah, right. All right, here is Frank in Toledo. Frank, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I've got to say, I'm not a teabagger, but I'd call myself a teabagger sympathizer. I'm opposed to raising the taxes on the rich, but I kind of agree with you about the military spending. I think we should cut it back. That's not to say that we shouldn't have a strong national defense, because we should. I just think we need to reevaluate our priorities. For instance, we shouldn't be as militarily invested in Europe as we are, because if the Europeans have not learned anything in the past 60 years, they deserve to have their cities bombed or rubble by each other again if they can't get along after 60 years.
Well, we were kind of involved in that as well.
Interesting.
The Air Force, the Navy, and the Marines are planning to buy 2,400 F-35s. This is, billions and billions of dollars that are what they would use for fighting the Soviet Union if they still had these MiGs. But why don't you want to tax the rich? Let's go back to some commie socialist, what was his name? Dwight D. Eisenhower. Why wouldn't we have like a tax rate that occurred under Dwight Eisenhower, that once you got to a certain level, the government took about 90% of your wealth? Because they didn't want impacted wealth, but because they knew that political power disproportionately flowed from that.
Well, for one thing, I would consider Eisenhower as, although a Republican, not what you would call a conservative. More conservative than what had been president to that point, but still not a true conservative.
Well, whatever. That's just labels. Why? What is wrong? I mean, why do you have people that wind up with a personal fortune of $45 billion? Let's say Bill Gates, who's gotten pretty generous with a lot of his money. Or you have the despicable Walton family that never worked for any of that. Just got given to him by his dad, and I forgot the figures now. They're worth about $50 billion altogether. I mean, what if you just left? I mean, here, this is real commie stuff. What if you just took like $90 billion from the six of them, Gates and the five Waltons, and left each of them with $1 billion? Wouldn't that be horrible?
I mean, well,
used it for the government, used it for whatever, for programs we need, or reducing the deficit, or whatever. But $1 billion, I mean, that's what they would be left with instead of having $45 billion.
My philosophy is this. I'm not saying I ever will be, but if I ever got to where Bill Gates or the Waltons are, I know better who I can help with that money and who I'd want to help with that money than the government.
Well, the Waltons don't want to help anybody at all. They just want to, keep it all for themselves. And if workers try to join a union in one of their shops, they close the shop down. They could be paying everybody $15-$20 an hour, and instead they conspire.
Instead, a large percentage of their staff is on
food stamps.
Assistance.
Yeah, and they actually conspire in order to drive the wages of already poor workers in other countries. And for what? I mean, they don't need to do it. They could pay other workers. They could pay, instead of paying people $1.25 an hour or less in other countries, they could pay people there $8-$10 an hour. But they choose to be just awful citizens of the planet. All right, Frank, thank you very much. The rich need some friends. They don't have a lot these days. Even the teabaggers don't like them. Let's see here. This is some open lines, by the way. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Here's Steve in Utica. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hey, I have four thoughts. First of all, that program you're talking about where they take some of the absolutely extraordinary wealth of those people. We could start off with George Soros, because he is pretty close to death, and he's an incredibly wealthy person that in a good year makes several hundred million dollars.
And, oh, he makes more than that. Oh, no, that's right. That's what he makes.
But I have three other thoughts.
And by the way, wait a minute. He's a liberal, and so is Gates, essentially, whereas the Waltons are far right-wingers. So I'm not making any distinction just because he gives a few bucks, the two other guys give a few bucks to good causes. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and the other thoughts are, on the racist thing, if you ever hear anyone say someone is articulate, how often do you hear someone that is European-American being referred to as articulate? Not very often. Usually it's something that is reserved for African-Americans, which is unfortunate, and kind of a derogatory thing when you hear someone referred to as articulate, meaning, oh, that person can actually speak the English language.
He's so articulate. I mean, it's just, what a slap in the face.
All right, thank you, Steve. Appreciate that. And who said, was that actually Senator Reid who referred to...
About Obama, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think so.
But, I mean, it was kind of weird that these Republicans suddenly were the big defenders of African-Americans when actually Reid, a stupid old white guy, was actually supporting Obama and saying why he wanted
to back. He was trying, but he couldn't get out of his racist ways. They don't even know how to do it.
let's see here. Before our break, here's Darius in Detroit. Darius, hi. You're on the air.
Yes, Peter, this is Darius.
Can you turn your radio completely off?
I'm calling about the Tony Blair's tribunal over in England.
Oh, yeah. But you got to turn your radio completely off.
Yes, I'm turning it down. Yeah, he got the tribunal over in England, and he's getting tried over for war crimes.
Well, wait a minute, Darius. Let me put this into some context. That the government, there's an independent commission that has been impaneled in Britain to see whether or not that Britain legitimately entered the war against Iraq, or was he just, as many have said, or one of his ex-ministers said, just a poodle for George W. Bush, and in fact lied to the British people in the manner that George W. Bush lied to the American people. And it's not a war crime. Trial. Both George Bush, Dick Cheney, boy, how fast we forget their names. Rumsfeld, and Blair all ought to be in The Hague for war crimes, as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly. This is why I'm for Mr. Kucinich, if he ever, tries to run again, this is what I'm for, and I hope he runs again, and I hope he wins, and I hope people listen to him,
He'll run again.
Well, he may run again,
diehard,
but like Ron Paul, he doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell because he doesn't have any big corporations willing to give tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars to him, and if we think that corporate interference and corporate buying and selling of politicians was bad previously, it's going to be absolutely, over the top now. All right, Darius, thank you very much. I got to take a break. By the way, and I should have mentioned this earlier, when you go to my website, Peter Werby, and sorry to keep spelling the name, I think, why do I have to do this over and over again? And I run into people and say, how do you spell your last name? Werbe. So it's peterwerby.com. Over on the right, it says books and other material relevant to this show, and let me see it. So in it now, because part of this has to do with, I can get it out, I swear.
you can do it.
Yeah, I'm trying to do about nine things here. What we've been talking about, one of them is this book called Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman, and it's called The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, and it's about how corporations have become recognized as people and what detrimental that is to democracy. The other thing is this book by Rich Benjamin, and it's an article by him called Searching for Whitetopia. You have Utopia. This is Whitetopia, an improbable journey to the heart of white America, and also a link to the U.S. Social Forum as well. All right, we will be right back with our final segment, and there's open lines.
You're listening to Night Call with...
When was the last time someone offered you a second chance to save thousands of dollars? If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, American Tax Relief is offering you a second chance to eliminate up to 85% of your delinquent taxes. Thousands of honest, hardworking Americans have turned to American Tax Relief for the help they need. Look, your tax problem isn't going to go away. In fact, it's only going to get worse unless you get help. Call 1-800-493-8159. Now you have qualified help in dealing with the IRS. This is the second chance you never had before to save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Get the second chance you deserve and save up to 85% on your delinquent taxes. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation to see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. Call right now for your second chance. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
Do you want a wireless laptop but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronics is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
Do you see chalky water spots on your dishes and tub that drive you crazy? Those spots are a warning that your plumbing may have a serious limescale buildup. What you can't see is limescale clogging your pipes, breaking down your appliances, and blocking their heating elements. And that could be costing you $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove hard water limescale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare. Just visit bestofwater.com. HydraCare has been sold for years by the major utility in England as the ideal treatment to reduce and prevent limescale. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents limescale buildup in your entire plumbing system. Guaranteed. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydraCare. Just go to bestofwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestofwater.com. That's bestofwater.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julene.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. 1 a.m., a couple of interesting guests. At least I think so. Dennis Coffey, the legendary session man with Motown, is going to talk about all the people he ran across. And also Craig Homan, government affairs lobbyist. I asked him about being a lobbyist and being opposed to lobbying. He's the lobbyist for Ralph Nader's Public Citizen Group, and he talks about the result of the Supreme Court's decision to allow corporations to donate unlimited funds to candidates. You know, this is amazing. After two decades of attempting to open Yucca Mountain, YUCCA in Nevada, which would be the sole repository for nuclear waste, the Obama government has finally said we're not funding it anymore. So it's not going to happen. It's not going to be there.
There's one for Obama.
Yeah. And the Department of Energy filed paperwork seeking to suspend licensing for the state. Everybody in that state, Republican and Democrat, wanted that not to happen. In Nye County, leaders and many residents see the repository as a potential economic engine. So, you know, they don't care. It brings them jobs. But mostly people did not want it. Said Cash Jazik, first of all, keep your mind, keep your cool. The sky is falling, but the sky isn't falling, whatever that means. He said he called Obama's nuclear policy schizoid, and this is absolutely correct, in that the president wants to build new nuclear reactors without having a solution for managing waste. If you're going to have new nuclear, says Jazik, eventually you're going to have a repository. There is now none. And they're talking about somewhere in here By the way, billions have been wasted on this Yucca Mountain site.
Yeah, talk about not planning for the future.
Yeah, I did not.
Just in case.
I forgot how many millions and billions were done. Actually, I don't know if it says in here, but in any event, so are there any supporters of nuclear power listening? You want to call 313-298-WRIF and tell us what are we going to do with the waste we have, and why it isn't insane to keep operating these things? They should all be closed down absolutely immediately. I mean, right now they have to be kept on site. So this, the most dangerous substance in the world, is sitting on the shores of Lake Erie, down there at Fermi 1 and 2, and they're talking about 3.
Awfully close.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah. We almost lost Detroit. That's a book. How to put that on that site where I list books and other material relevant to the show. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
All right, let's go back to our phone calls, and let's see. Waiting patiently, Scott from Westland. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Pete. Hi, Jalene. Well, I guess I was hoping to get to two things tonight. First of all, there's good news about taxes, but also I was going to repeat myself on job creation. But first of all, I heard on the news that the state of Oregon seems to have taken the lead in initiating what they call a so-called graduated income tax, which is one of those obfuscating, you know, phrases, which basically says that they're going to increase the income tax on people who make over $125,000 a year to solve their state's budget problem.
And that was voted on a referendum, that the people of Oregon said if you make a lot of money, that you're going to have to pay a little bit more taxes. And it's not a hell of a raise. I can't remember the story. What was it, about 3% or something?
Right. Well, I know very little about it, but I'm glad to see they're taking the lead. Now, again, since people have been invoking this passage of time thing, you know, I want to talk about job creation. I just want to let people know where I got this idea, okay? Like 26 years ago, I was watching Canadian television, Channel 9 out of Windsor, and remember, Reagan was in office, and so that was kind of a subversive broadcast. So I saw this a public service announcement from Ontario Hydro, which is like DTE or Mishcon.
Right.
Power. It's, you know, basically Ontario's big utility. And said, well, here's the home of the future. And this is this and this and this. Said, oh, by the way, in the backyard, you know, there's a, this is a fuel cell. And so this fuel cell provides, you know, the, you know, all the electricity that the home needs, you know, cleanly from natural gas. So I guess you could make one of those moon slogans about it. If we could put a fuel cell on the moon, which we did, why can't we put one in your backyard? This has been on the table for 26 years.
I know. We don't seem to be moving very quickly towards that, or towards any massive conversion to alternative fuels. Why are they even alternative fuels? I mean, are we really going to keep going with oil? Didn't anybody see Avatar?
Right.
All right, Scott, thank you very much for joining us. Here is Dave. Dave is in Redford. Dave, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I used to live in Oceana County for a little while, near Lake Michigan.
Right.
And as for welfare stories, I can't remember if this was before welfare reform, but there was a guy who got welfare for being an alcoholic. Well, so they'd give him money, and he'd buy booze for it, so he was being paid for being a professional alcoholic.
But what I asked, Dave, is what's the purpose of
these
stories?
That was over 20 years ago. I just found this out last night, that there hasn't been money given for at least 20 years.
For able-bodied men.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, I think he's saying that he was had a disability because of alcohol. But what's the purpose of this story? Is this like it's illustrative of a whole category of people that are on welfare?
No.
Okay, good. All right, thank you. Appreciate your call. Because so I don't understand these stories. What I said, there is in everything that you have, in every occupation, in important occupations. I mean, think about what kind of corruption there is in politics, in medicine, in police, judges.
Everything.
Yeah. So
it's
there's a percentage of corruption. Where the hell did I
Which
do
one? It? I wanted to say that we have some open lines and about 15 minutes left, so if you have something you want to say, 313-298-WIF.
Yeah. In the New York Times business section, which you can get online as well, it's almost the most important section, something called BAE settles allegations of bribery. And, this is important. BAE Systems, Europe's largest military contractor, agreed on Friday to plead guilty to two criminal charges and pay nearly $450 million in penalties in the United States and Britain to end long-running investigations into questionable payments made to win huge contracts overseas. And it goes on. So when you read this, also bank reform talks crumble in Senate, so they don't have to worry about that. Usually, and I haven't even looked through here. You just find prosecution after prosecution. More members of Madoff family agree to freeze of assets. I'm surprised if there's not more of this in here.
The corruption.
Yeah, I mean, so this is where the real levels of corruption and stealing our money. It's not a guy there aren't able-bodied men on. Welfare is, we don't even call it an assistance, but it's women with dependent children, and I've seen them driving them in Cadillacs, yeah. But rather, the important part of it is that where our money's going is going, it's being taken from above us. Don't worry about those below us.
They're not living the high life. They're not,
And how many of you are scamming? Come on.
Yeah, really. Look in the mirror.
Yeah. Here's Mike from Monroe. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you guys doing?
Good.
Good.
I just want to tell Jalene, I'm kind of looking forward to next week when you're by yourself, and maybe more people have like a more open of a dialect instead of getting half a point out and having Peter cut him off.
All right, you're out of here. Bye.
Oh, jeez. Peter, that was terrible. I do tend to let people go a little longer, but everyone's different. You have your way of doing it, and I have mine.
What was his name?
Peter.
Call back if you want.
Call next week. I'll let you go on and on.
Call now.
Oh, you can call now. Now, that's a first.
Just because I did it for effect. And just, but we can do this. Oh, no, that's the wrong. That was for him.
That wasn't for him.
No, it's
that was for the teabaggers.
We got to fight the battle of church and state, church and state, church and state. We got to fight the battle of church and state, or the walls will come a tumbling down.
All right, what's new with religion this week? Gail Haggard, she is the wife of Ted Haggard. In fact, she's just written a book, Why I Stayed, The Choices I Made in My Darkest Hour. You remember old Ted, big anti-gay guy.
Head of that giant church.
14,000-member New Life Church in Colorado Springs, where all the right-wingers hang out. President of the National Association of Evangelicals, and he's just doing blow.
He was doing blow. And he had a little boyfriend.
Yeah, a little boyfriend.
Prostitute. But he paid for him.
In Gail Haggard's new memoir about the trials and tribulations she went through after her husband Ted's involvement with a gay prostitute and his solicitation of drugs came to light in 2006. He was a big supporter, of course, of George W. Bush.
Good.
She says she forgives him. He has put it all behind him. And he is now free of any and all homosexual compulsions. Yeah.
I mean, that is revulsion coming from her. I'll tell you what. I couldn't even believe this when I could believe it. But it's so upsetting that this woman considers homosexual activity a compulsion.
Yeah.
I mean, couldn't it be that your husband really likes, doing dudes? Get over it,
Gabe. Gail.
Get over it,
Your
Gail.
Husband's gay.
He's gay.
Maybe he's bisexual.
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah, because you know what? That really exists.
You know, there was, why can't I think of this guy's name? Famous American writer. He said, there are no homosexuals and there are no heterosexuals. There are homosexual acts and heterosexual acts.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think he's gay, though.
I do, too.
Ted.
The other guy.
Yeah. That American was the leader of the groups that were charged on Thursday with abducting children in Idaho. She's a businesswoman. She's doing the Lord's work. She kept talking about God. And these people, the Christians and Jews and Muslims and Baha'i faith people and Buddhists and all that I know, they don't don't ever talk about they're doing God's will. They just do what they got to do. In fact, they call it social witness. If they're out there advocating for the poor, or if they're out there trying to stop one of Bush's and now Obama's miserable wars, they're doing it because this is what they're led to do because of, not only because of their spiritual beliefs, but because of their, you know, fundamental ethical beliefs. But as soon as someone starts talking about they're doing it for God, I go, get out of here, man.
Yeah, it looks like they have to proving a point and need to publicly tell everyone without just doing it.
Well, it's also, it gives them special standing. You know, you're just you. I'm doing God's work.
Right.
So,
what have you done lately?
What's her name? Laura Silsby. She had some problems, even though, you know, she was trying to help the children by taking them to the Dominican Republic. She had a complicated financial history that involves complaints from employees over unpaid wages, state liens on company bank account, and lawsuits in small claims court. In other words, instead of intervening in Haiti, she might have done well to stay at home. She had a business called Personal Shopper and faced multiple legal claims. She's been named 14 times in complaints from employees over unpaid wages. And let's see, her house was foreclosed on. Man, what a piece of work. This is the most despicable thing, though. An anti-abortion group has erected 60 billboards outside of Atlanta, in Atlanta, rather. And they say, black children are an endangered species.
This is
sick.
Sick and completely mean, awful. Mean-spirited, yeah. Horrible.
Now,
karma is such a bitch, and I hope they get it back sooner rather than later, yeah. That which is not very karmic.
The group responsible insists they are not exaggerating that, in fact, black children are an endangered species. This contradicts all federal data. The billboards, which show a close-up of a worried-looking African-American boy, are an effort to highlight data showing that black women get a disproportionate number of abortions, especially in Georgia, and that the number in Georgia is increasing. Now, Catherine Davis, the minority outreach coordinator for Georgia Right to Leave, Georgia Right to Life, sorry. We were talking about making assumptions. I have no assumption that she's African American. She could very well be Euro American. She says the impact of abortion has become so great that it's begun to impact, fertility rate. So this is what these crazy right wingers like, you know, to put some African American up in something that just so insults black
people.
She's
projecting. I mean, you know,
yeah.
Really.
They're going to have 80 billboards for this.
80 billboards. Do you know how much that costs? Billboards are expensive.
2006, 57.4% of abortions in Georgia were performed on black women, even though blacks make up about 30% of the population. So what are we supposed to do with that data? They assume, how about this, that where did they say this insanity? Oh, yeah. Their website connects abortion to segregation, saying that after the civil rights era, racists went underground. And today, abortion is the tool they use to stealthily target blacks for extermination. I mean, this is just so insane that you can't even talk about it, because the racists that went underground are so anti-black that they would love. That's what she is saying, isn't it? But they don't. But they're also anti-abortion. And they bomb abortion clinics and what have you, and kill,
kill in the name of what they consider murder.
Jesus, yeah. But in any event, so what's up here? Why do you have these statistics? Almost 60% of abortions in Georgia were performed on black women. 30% of the, although they're only 30% of the population. Here's a clue. They make up disproportionately the poor.
That's right, and birth control and things like that are not.
So one of the things that you could do would be to have free birth control. As part of a national health plan. By the way, there's no evidence that abortions have made black children unusually endangered. The fertility rate or births per thousand of childbearing age among black women remains higher than the national average and has inched up in recent years. So, there you go. Okay.
There's a real head shaker.
We got a lot more on religion, but all right. Let's see if we can get some final calls. It says here, Mike from Monroe, he claims you told him to call you back. I did. Mike, hi. You're back on
here. How are you doing, man? You just cut me off.
I did. That was like a goof on you.
He was playing.
I know. I understand the whole humor factor in it, but anybody that ever crosses your opinion on anything, you do it.
Not always. He lets people go on. It depends.
Yeah, very rarely.
Well, you are you like a radio program director?
No, sir, why?
Oh, okay. I mean, because the program directors usually tell air talent how to run their programs.
No, I'm just saying you ask people to call in and give your opinion, but if it's anything contradictory to the propaganda that you throw out, you cut them off.
I'm terrible. I'm just like these right-wing guys, some of these awful right-wingers who make up about 90% of the talk galaxy on radio and television who do the same thing. You know what we say in Detroit? Paybacks are MFs, I have to say. But let me ask you this. Do you have any, other than the opinion that I cut everybody off before I cut you off, do you have any opinion on anything that's been said?
Yeah, actually, the welfare.
Yeah.
I have a job, and I'm held accountable for, the drug testing, right? I can get drug tested every couple months.
Yeah.
If you're on welfare or some kind of assistance, that's kind of your employer. And if they tell you that they want you drug tested, if you don't like it, get the hell off the assistance.
Do you do anything that has to do with safety, driving a truck or driving a bus or anything like
that? Yes, sir. I drive a truck.
Well, that
makes sense.
That makes sense, but I don't think any employer has the right, other than for safety purposes, has the right to drug test to anyone. I mean, given some of the unfortunate accidents we've seen in recent years, perhaps, there is a good reason to do it. But I don't think that an employer has a right to a drug-free workplace, but a drug-free work force is none of his or her business unless it has to do with the safety of the public, which is my opinion.
Of course it is.
Hey, Mike?
Yes?
You know what happens in radio if you pass the drug test?
What?
They'll fire you. It's not allowed.
You have to be when you come in. You have to fail a drug test. But
see, I believe a business has every right, though. Like, that's a private business. If you don't like it, you don't have to work there. You want the accountability for Congress. You want the accountability for government for, where all of our money's going. Well, I'm a hard-working American. I get a third of my paycheck every year. I work, and I never see nothing from it. I'm thankful that I don't need assistance, and I know that people really do. And I feel for them, but...
I mean, don't you know anyone who smokes pot?
Oh, yes. And let me tell you something. I'm 25 years old. I smoked weed, and I did all kinds of drugs until I got a job to where it was worth giving up.
I hear you.
I haven't touched drugs since I've started driving.
Well, that's good.
What if you quit driving?
Well, wait a minute. Before, actually, we're running out of time. I don't know if, I think you hit the key to it, that 25% of your taxes go away and your medical costs are rising. There's wars being fought on two continents. There's, the military-industrial complex soaks up all of this and we get squat back. I don't know if you heard, it sounds like you've been listening a long time, but that guy from Australia that was just ticking off all of the benefits that he gets for his taxes or what people get in Canada or even England, which ain't doing so well. Listen, this time I do have to go, Mike, because I got one more caller and then we got to end the show. But thank you. And you can talk to Jalene next week and she'll cut you off.
No,
here's Sean.
I won't.
Here's Sean in Ann Arbor. Sean, go ahead. You're our last caller.
All righty. Hey, Pete, you're doing a great job out there, and loved your show over all these years. Just want to say one thing. Of course, I'm a great right-wing, don't want to identify as Republican, but one thing you're missing in your great socialistic endeavor, just like all the great leaders missed, it works, the community works, the communal thing works, but the one thing they took out of it was God. And in the New Testament, they left God in it, and it all worked out for them. So have a good night.
Wait. No, I didn't understand.
He's
the
trying
thing.
To get. Out. He's saying that the key to all of this is God. Socialism would be okay if there were God in it.
Well, I know there. The Pledge of Allegiance was written by a Christian socialist, right? You know that.
Oh, I'm sorry. What did you say, Pete?
The Knights of Columbus dude in the 30s is the one who added in...
No.
Right?
That was in the 50s.
Okay.
But anyway, the Pledge of Allegiance was written by a Christian socialist. So there, and there's also something called the Catholic Worker Movement. And oddly enough, well, it's kind of complicated, but the popes, going back, I think, into the like the 19th century, always said that the dignity of labor and the recognition of labor unions was important. But in our, we have a godless country. We have a constitution that doesn't mention anything about religion, other than to say the very first amendment says that Congress shall make no law establishing religion, because, and or, you know, prevent the practice thereof. But the most important thing, more than the right to free speech or assemble for redress grievances or any of that stuff, was that Congress shall make no law establishing religion. So concerned were the founding fathers about the pernicious effect of religion being intertwined with the political state. And if you say one nation under God, I say Iran. All right. Thanks, Sean. Ooh. Appreciate it. Ooh, that was like a cold way to end it.
Yeah.
Huh? All right. Well,
we'll see you in a couple weeks, Peter.
Yeah. And I'll tell you where I've been.
I'll do my best to cover for you.
Cover for me. All right. Cover me. All right. But I'm going to be here for another hour doing some recorded interviews. Stay tuned for them. Hey, Jalene. Thank you. Jade.
Thank you so much.
All right. And we'll have a podcast of this available by, in about 11 hours.
Beautiful.
All right. Beautiful.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
It's another new year, and your debt is higher than ever. Credit card balances that keep growing. Rising medical bills. Maybe you lost your job, or you're afraid of losing your home. That's the bad news. But you can work through your debt problems with help from Credit Card Relief. No, we're not a consolidation loan, not another one of those credit counseling deals, and not bankruptcy. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. If you're struggling with too much credit card debt, call us for a free consultation. We have an outstanding record of performance helping people get out of debt in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars. Call Credit Card Relief right now. The consultation is free and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. 101 The Riff.
These days, people of all ages, including adults, can have a perfect smile. Thanks to today's technology, people with crooked teeth may no longer need to wear metal braces. One option many adults prefer is invisible braces. Instead of the typical metal bands or brackets that are cemented to teeth, these braces are clear plastic trays. Some advantages of invisible braces are they can be removed for eating and for brushing and flossing. They are practically invisible to see, and they are less irritating to gums than traditional braces. Keep in mind that invisible braces are only available for people who need minor corrective work. If you are considering braces and would like to learn more about invisible braces, speak with your dentist. You're never too old for a beautiful smile. For the ADA Dental Minute, I'm Dr. Maria Lopez-Howell. For more information, visit our website at ada.org.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Boy, listening here in Detroit, I don't have to tell you what a music town this is. We're talking rock and roll. We're talking rhythm and blues. We're talking Motown. We're talking jazz. This is the home of rock and roll. I think somebody sang about that once. And joining me in our studios is one of the people that just made so much of it happen. In fact, I was looking through all the credits that he's done over his lifetime, and I'm thinking, this is going to be the hardest part of the interview. How do I introduce him in a manner that doesn't take up the next 10 10 minutes. His name is Dennis Coffey, and his music you may have heard it and not even realized it. He's had million record bestsellers. He's been on Motown records. In fact, he created the sound, including the famous guitar intro into the Temptations, Cloud Nine. He's played on hundreds of Motown albums and introduced such innovations as the wah-wah pedals into Motown recording studio, and there are some stories here as well. He appears regularly at his quartet with a Detroit treasure. It's the Baker's Keyboard Lounge on Livernois near 8 Mile Road. He's a former funk brother. He's played guitar on over 100 soul music gold records, on and on and on. He's played with people, the Temptations, Stevie Wonder, Diana Ross, the Four Tops, Quincy Jones, Marvin Gaye, Martha Reeves, Ringo Starr. It's a lot to talk about, and let's see if we can get some of this in. In fact, we've invited Dennis Coffey here because of the paperback edition being just released by the University of Michigan Press. The book is Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars, something that Dennis Coffey knows a lot about. Dennis, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks, Peter. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm exhausted from the introduction. You look calm and at ease. Man, what a career. I mean, how have you just maintained just the love of music?
The love of music, and like you said, this is a rock and roll town, and the people support the music, so a lot of places to play, and it's always great. I think it's the DNA of the city, and me being a part of the city, that's the music.
Well, tell me a little about, you know, way back when, because when we even say that Bob Seger and Iggy Pop are from Detroit. Actually, they're from Ann Arbor, but you're from way far away, right, in Michigan?
No, actually, my cousins lived in the Upper Peninsula, but I went to McKenzie High School in Detroit.
Oh, okay. So you, no wonder. So you heard the music. You felt the beat.
I was there, and of course, I went from there to Wayne State, so all my education has been in the city of Detroit.
Now, with a few exceptions, most of the people that we associate with Detroit rock and roll went into the type of music that we call classic rock now, that we associate like with the old Grandy Ballroom and what have you. But you went into Motown, you went into funk, you went into R&B. What? How did that happen?
Well, also, I played at the Grandy Ballroom.
I knew you did.
I played with the Lyman Woodard Trio and Melvin Davis, and we were the opening act for the MC5, and we were doing psychedelic jazz. It went over very well at the place, so a little bit there and there, you know. But I started very early on, where my cousins in the UP played country guitar, and they showed me some chords, and I was just pretty much infatuated. You know, I had to learn the guitar, so... once I got my hands on one, I practiced, and I did my first record date at 15.
Hmm. Now, as had your discography here, at least somewhat of the incredible groups that you've played with through Motown, and Motown famously had their backup musicians who never got a lot of credit, and you talk about that in Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars, but it mostly, well, certainly all the, with a few exceptions, the stars were African American, and so were the Funk Brothers, the people in back. You, a white boy from McKenzie High, how did you wind up in this mix?
Well, it was interesting because I was playing in the Frolic Show Bar with the Lyman Woodard, which is generally an African American jazz club, and Maury Baker's in these places. And I found early on when I was doing the Northern Soul records, even before that, that it was about there wasn't a color thing. It was, can you play or can't play? Whatever color you were, if you couldn't play, you were out. So it just I worked my way through the ranks with the Northern Soul, through the Golden World records and all those other kind of things, because of my ability. Whatever I played, they felt added to what the record was.
So that was a good thing. I mean, there was a civil rights movement that actually had that called for integration, and there actually was a cultural expression that people weren't judging you by the color of your skin. In reverse, but rather, can this man play the guitar? And Dennis Coffey, they certainly appreciated your work. You tell us about your work at Motown and some of these songs where they're certainly not credit on the 45. The band never got that kind of credit that it was due. Tell us maybe, like I was mentioning, the Temptations song.
The first session I did at Motown, of course, was Cloud Nine by the Temptations. And I got a call one day. I'd been a house session guy at Golden World. And before that, I was doing Del Shannon and the Volumes and all the other folks before that. And I got a call one day from James Jamerson, who was the legendary Funk Brother bass player at Motown. And he says, I want to introduce you to Hank Cosby, which is Stevie Wonder's producer. And Hank got on the phone and said, we're doing this producer's workshop upstairs off Golden World Studios, which Motown had purchased Golden World, and said, we're doing that, and Jamerson wants you to join his band, which means we'd be up there 4 nights a week from, 9:30 to 10:30. Actually, really, it was 7 to 9:30. And it'd give the producers a chance to rehearse some of the songs before going in the studio.
And this was what year?
This was probably 67, 68.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were up there as a house band to give the producers a little more time before they had to incur studio time to experiment. And after a couple of months, a producer came in, which is Norman Whitfield. And he came in with the charts to Cloud Nine. And he says, I'm going to work over this song and see what we can come up with. And I happened to have this pedal in my case, a wah-wah pedal in a bag next to me that made the guitar have that wah-wah sound, and I just pulled it out on the intro. I said, hey, that looks like this will fit in here. So I put it on there, cranked it on the intro, and Norman looked at me and says, that's it, man. That's what I've been looking for.
Well, Barry Gordy, ran a pretty tight ship. Oh, so was he on board with your innovations?
I'm not sure. Actually, what happened was, within 2 weeks, Norman had me over to Hitsville and actually recording the record with the Funk Brothers, for the Temptations. And I remember one time I was in the studio and I was doing this wild feedback stuff in the overdub room of this one song for the Supremes, and I looked up and Berry Gordy and Diana Ross were looking in the window at me like they had wondered what this guy's doing back here.
And did it make the record finally?
It was in the record. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I had talked to Berry Gordy last year, and I told him that he was the only one in the city that really appreciated the talent that was here and that it was had value and started his company here. And he said this was the only city that he could have started Motown in.
Well, certainly besides the enormous appreciation that all of us have for Berry Gordy's innovative genius when it came to music, recognizing talent out of the city, people, there have been critics that say he ran Motown too tightly and he wasn't open to new innovations. How did you find him?
I was independent contractor, so I worked for Motown and Holland Dozier and Holland and everybody else, so I was not a privy to any of the politics. And when Norman called me to do a session, he wanted me to do what I do, and he apparently politically could make that happen. So I remember I did on the Cloud Nine session, it was a tambourine player that had played on the session for a short period of time that was with Motown. And I ran into him, about 5 years ago, and he said, you should have seen the look on the faces of the Funk Brothers when you started playing that wah-wah pedal. He says, they were just looking at you. They didn't know what that was.
A lot of this is recounted in Dennis Coffey's paperback edition of his Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars. It's available through the University of Michigan Press, I'm sure, at bookstores around town as well. Actually, in Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars, you tell a pretty interesting story about how you're recording at 4 in the morning, and Berry Gordy did not like his session, even his session people, working at other gigs. And can you relate that story? And it's pretty interesting.
Usually the Funk Brothers has an agreement signed with Motown, exclusivity agreement. Because I was independent, I never did that. And we were doing a recording session at United Sound Studios near Wayne State University, and it was 4 o'clock in the morning. We all got ready and heard this knock on the back door. Now, it was still dark out, and it was raining out and everything, and we just figured as a musician. And I opened the door, and Ralph Seltzer came in, and he was Barry's right-hand guy, and he saw Eddie Willis and Jamerson on the session. He ran over, and he pointed at him. He says, I see you guys. I caught you now. And then he ran back out the door, and I think they got fined or something.
Yeah, in the book you say you think they got fined $500. So.
That's what I heard.
So The session players, the Funk Brothers, you always hear they were notoriously underpaid and undercredited. Do you think that's fair?
The first time I was aware of getting credits on an album at Motown because they did not credit the musicians, I did an album for Ashford and Simpson at that time, and Valerie put my name on there and the rest of the Funks on the album cover because I had done a guitar solo, so Valerie Simpson appreciated that and put our names on it. And she said, because she lived in New York, she said it really was difficult to convince Motown to let her do that.
Yeah. Well, if since you also, Dennis Coffey, play jazz, you know that the old jazz albums, the LPs, they would have extensive liner notes and even detailing when and where things were recorded and who was, the engineer sometimes for it, and would list all of the personnel, and on jazz radio, which they still do, they name every single player, and even if it's like an octet or, you know, even a band, they'll sometimes name everybody, where you pick up some of the old LPs and it'll say Cream, and that's it, and some like cool photographs. Did it surprise you either way that either that you didn't get credit on all the records you're on, or that when you started getting it?
I think because I had already carved out an independent career for myself, and I was working with a lot of other people who did give backup musicians credit, but once I started having hits on my own and I was doing Soul Train and playing on Mike Douglas Show and what have you, I ended up getting my own spotlight. I think the Funks, until Standing in the Shadows of Motown, never really got the recognition that they truly deserve.
Yeah, in fact, I was just going to bring that up. I saw that wonderful, absolutely wonderful documentary, Standing in the Shadows of Motown, which was about the Funk Brothers, and you were in it. And tell us a little about that, how it was made, and whose I actually knew whose idea it was and all, but it's out of my brain right now. So
Alan Slutsky had written a book about James Jamerson, and I gave him a few anecdotes for the book, because Jamerson was my best friend at Motown, and Alan told me how it happened is he had been trying to get this thing together, especially a touring band, and then the movie idea came up, and he was just on an airplane, and the guy sitting next to him had just sold this computer company for like a gazillion dollars, and quite by chance, Alan pitched him on this movie thing, and that's kind of how that really got started.
And now some of the Funk Brothers righteously have been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that previously, again, they were kind of ignored.
Yeah, I had played at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame twice already, once with the legendary Les Paul when he was still alive, and they had Slash and Richie Sambora, and they had Skunk Baxter and guitar players up, whatever, all doing this, so I did the show with him, and then before that I had played with Larry Carlton and John Pizzarelli on a first visit to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
You know, it's interesting because you mentioned early on, when you were still in your middle teens, playing country music and then soul music and jazz. Actually, you know, you were saying you're playing jazz with the late Lyman Woodard, and now you're playing a lot of jazz again. Is there any one love, or is the love just the guitar, or is there any style of music that fires you up more than another?
I've always been the love of the guitar. You know, the first real guitar legend I thought was Django Reinhardt.
Yeah.
And then it progressed, you know, up through Les Paul, obviously, and then Wes Montgomery I got to know, and I used to go over Joe Pass's house, and, you know, then I studied the B.B. King and the Chuck Berrys and all the other folks, and I'm still a student of the instrument. What I do now at Northern Lights on Wednesday nights is I'll play straight ahead jazz, and we're going to this funk on steroids, rock, heavy duty stuff, and it all seems to fit. I don't know.
Tell everybody where the Northern Lights is so they can catch
it's on Baltimore between 2nd and 3rd, so a block or two away from the Fisher Theater. We're there every Wednesday night at 7, and we do, like I say, we do the jazz, and then we do some pretty extensive rock funk kind of stuff.
Dennis Coffey is my guest on the Peter Werby Show, and we're talking about his brand new book, brand new paperback edition of his book, Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars. It's University of Michigan Press. There'll be a link on my website, peterwerby.com. It's a very, very good memoir of, well, not just back in the day. It takes us right up. And in the back, there's a selected discography, which takes up page after page after page. I mean, I'm just I'm amazed at everybody that's on here and the bands you've played with and so many different genres of music. And I was looking through here. Oh yeah, music gear. Although I don't even play, and I found this interesting. Why did it occur to you to put that in there? To put in the list of the gear, everything from your first kid. I found it fascinating, but maybe because you thought readers would find it fascinating.
Yeah, and then I get queries on my website, okay. Which is DennisCoffeeSite.com. And people will ask me, what did you use on this record? What gear did you use on that record? And said, well, we're trying to do this session, and we have this song, and we want that sound. What did you use on it? So I replied to them. So that's what gave me the idea that they'd probably like to know, what I'm using. And last year, Gibson gave me a new, brand-new 355 guitar.
Wow. Well, in under music gear, there's early years, and then it says later years, and you talk about your third electric guitar, your second amp, and then it says first distortion device, loosened tube and amp at Bell Sound in New York while recording with the Royal Tones. Can you? And then something kind of pretty funny happened.
Well, here I said, I was playing rock and roll in the clubs. You know, we all started playing rock and roll in teen clubs when we were 16. So by the time we were old enough to work in bars, we already had 2 to 3, 4 years experience playing rock and roll under our belts already. So I had joined a band called the Royal Tones, and they had a few rock and roll hits, the early rock and roll. In fact, Ace Records has got a whole discography they just released in London on the Royal Tones, one of the first rock and roll bands back in the 50s and early 60s. So that whole scenario... We were recording one of our songs with the Royal Tones at Bell Sound in New York, and I had this Fender amp I was using. And in transport, when I was driving there, because we were working in Jersey Shore, the tube got loose. And so I played the amp, and I heard the sound. I says, man, this sounds good, man. Nice distortion. This was before they had distortion pedals and stuff. And I says, man, this really makes this thing sound funky, man. So I recorded it that way. And then later on, when I heard the final track, the engineer at Bell Sound heard that distortion and thought it was a mistake, and he filtered it up and cleaned it up. And I says, oh, no.
Hey, it never occurred to me when I saw Hendrix and when I saw Pete Townsend do the kind of distortion they did by, in the feedback. Usually feedback was something you didn't want, and distortion was something you didn't want. Where did this all come from? I mean, because the early jazz from, with Charlie Christian through like the 1940s, it was always these effectless guitars without effects, and it was this clean sound. Whose brain did all of the, suddenly pop out of to do this distortion?
I think if you look at the evolution of rock and roll coming back from, you had a certain period in time where you had Chuck Berry, for instance. I mean, what he was playing was to a jazz person kind of rude, And so it was a rude music. It was an in-your-face music, and it was a music that represented how the kids felt at that time. And I was, of course, playing teen clubs and stuff, so we were playing. I was in the beginning of it. I was playing music as rock and roll was evolving in the 50s, and somehow someone came up with this distortion pedal. I'm not sure which company. I know the Vox pedal came from London over on, and they were using it over there. I think the psychedelic movement also added this distortion thing. And of course, Jimi Hendrix, he'd play solos, and the feedback distortion was part of his arsenal of sustain.
Mm-hmm.
And the fuzz tone got connected because it gave you a sustain like a horn. You got, like when I recorded Scorpio, I had 9 guitars just playing the melody with distortion pedals. I thought that was a good way to go.
Scorpio was one of Dennis Coffey's million seller hit songs, by the way. Dennis Coffey is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. The book is is Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars from University of Michigan Press, and it's both a memoir. It's got great stuff in it. Pete, we were talking about your gear. Your gear is like all over the place in museums and everything. Where have you left some of it?
I sent some things to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but for some reason they just stored them, and after a while I got kind of, when they kept wanting to renew the contract, I said, well, if you're not really going to use them, why don't you send them back? So there's a musician's museum in Nashville that has some of those items, and I gave the wah-wah pedal and Echoplex to the Motown Museum, because a lot of time at the museum, I'll be down there with some of the Motown alumni, and we'll talk to the tour groups in Studio A so we can give them a flavor of how it was to really be there and work there.
Wow, that's great. You know, when you were coming up, I'm sure there must have been guitar players that you just listened to on LPs over and over again and maybe even thought, I don't know, am I ever going to be able to play like that? Now I'm sure people, young guitar players, can listen to Dennis Coffey and have the same feeling. But who are some of the people when you listened to and just said, man, am I ever going to be able to do that? Or were you happy all the time with how you played?
I was just consumed, but with the rock and roll and the rockabilly guys. When I first heard, you know, even Scotty Moore playing with Elvis and these kind of guys, if you took guitar lessons in this town, none of the guitar teachers had a clue what that was. And so I was trying to figure that stuff out. I had to figure it out off the records because there was nobody in town that was playing it because it was so new. And when I played down in Memphis a few years ago, I got to meet Scotty Moore, and I talked to James Burton, you know, which I talked to periodically. And I saw the original Sun Rhythm Section, DJ Fontana and some of those guys do a whole rockabilly set down in Memphis about 2 or 3 years ago. And I said, I can see how that evolved. Sonny Burgess was the singer. He was one of the first guys that signed it at Sun Records. And he got up with this rockabilly band, and they did this hardcore rockabilly set, man. And it was amazing. I can see how this stuff started down there.
Now, you've got a lot of things going on, as we said, monthly at the Northern Lights Bar on Baltimore. Did we say the cross street where?
Between 2nd and 3rd.
Okay. Yeah, a nice room. I've been there before. But and I certainly will, I'm remiss in not knowing that you were playing there. I'll certainly get over there. And Wednesdays, was it?
7 o'clock Wednesday night, 7 to 11.
Okay, sounds great. And monthly from different times at the incredible Jewel of Baker's Keyboard Lounge. But hey, you're going to New York in July?
I'll be doing Lincoln Center as part of the Ponderosa Stomp, where initially Dr. Ike, who runs Ponderosa Stomp, wanted me to play in New Orleans. And he called me at the time, and that was before Katrina, so he had to move the event to Memphis because of Katrina, and then he asked us to make it a benefit for the Katrina folks. So I played in Memphis at the Gibson Guitar Factory as part of the Ponderosa Stomp, and I had Little Buck Cynical in the band with Buck Wizzatico and B3 and the Funky Horns from New Orleans. And then the following year, I went back and did the House of Blues in New Orleans, which I've done twice, and we did South by Southwest, and this New York thing is a spinoff off of that.
Oh, Dennis Coffey, I'm sure listeners, just hearing this broadcast, let alone the people that are familiar with your career, probably say, this guy has done everything, been everywhere. Is there anything left undone? Are you thinking, I still want to?
I still want to learn how to play this instrument. I was over in Barcelona for Red Bull in Spain lecturing all these young kids, and I did some overdubs. I added some guitar to their tracks on their laptops, and they gave me a standing ovation. And I'm still moving on, you know, the more things. You know, I've been to Germany. I did a 9-day book tour and played in the U.K., you know, to me, the year's just begun, and I'm always a phone call away from who knows, you know. So I'm just out here learning my craft, and I'm a perpetual student of the instrument. And like Les Paul was 93 when I played with him, God bless him, and so he was out there still playing.
Well, I was just going to say that, in fact, that's interesting, is that Les Paul died, what, at 94, right?
No, he just died here about 8 months ago. I got invited to the memorial in New York City, but
I meant his age.
Pardon?
I meant his age, not in 1990. That he died at 94 years of
yes,
age.
Yeah, yes,
yeah,
yes.
Just about 8 months ago.
Yes, he did.
And this man loved to play the guitar so much that, what was it, he had his hand, his wrist, surgically it had to be frozen because of something, but he wanted to just set his hand up.
He had a car accident, and when he was in surgery to repair his arm, he had them set his arm permanently so he could hold his guitar in that hand.
And he probably would still think, you're a kid.
It's funny. We all got done playing, like I said, Richie Sambor and Slash and myself and all the guitar slingers and Skunk Baxter and everybody and Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top. We all get done playing this tribute to Les, and we're all taking solos with him and stuff. And at the end, he looks at the audience and deadpans and says, I think I'll go home and slash my wrist.
Oh, boy. Well, no need to, for sure. He was an American treasure. Dennis Coffey, you are as well, just playing these genres of music and making it come alive for generations of people appreciating the music. The book is Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars, the paperback edition of Dennis Coffey's book. It's available from the University of Michigan Press, also, of course, around at bookstores. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and I will have a link there. Dennis, thank you so much for being on my show.
Thank you, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Join the Rip this evening from 6:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at Terry's Terrace on Jefferson, 1 mile south of Metro Beach in Harrison Township. It's Endless King Crab Night for only $29.99. Also mention the Rip to get free crab stuffed mushrooms with two or more orders of crab legs. Plus, the first 10 people through the door will get a free Rip t-shirt. It's courtesy of Terry Terrace, Terry's Terrace, and 101 WRF, everything that rocks.
Are you having trouble paying your credit card bills? You didn't expect to get so deep in debt, but now you need a way out, a way to relieve the anxiety, a way to avoid disaster. If you have over $12,000 in credit card debt, call Debt Settlement USA at 1-877-560-8877. Debt Settlement USA has a proven debt reduction program that can cut the amount you owe and get you out of debt faster than you could on your own. They've saved millions of dollars for their clients, and they can help you get back in control again, too. If your resolution is to get out of debt, call Debt Settlement USA for a free consultation. 1-877-560-8877. Your call is confidential, and there's no obligation. If you have over $12,000 in credit card bills, they can cut the amount you owe and help you get out of debt. Call Debt Settlement USA right now. 1-877-560-8877. That's 1-877-560-8877.
101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Is this on? Thank you. All right. Good morning, students. This is your principal speaking. Please listen closely to the following schedule changes. First period will be replaced by sleeping in. If second period will be replaced by warm weather. Third period will be replaced by belly flops. Fourth period will be replaced by goofing around. Fifth period will be replaced by batting leadoff. But there will be no changes to lunch. It will be in session every day.
School may be out for summer, but lunch is always in session. If your kids rely on subsidized school meals, call Gleaners Community Food Bank of Southeastern Michigan at 1-866-GLEANER or visit feedingamerica.org/summermeals.
A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
My mom is my hero. She goes into burning buildings. She finds people inside who need to be saved. She helps them get out, even when she can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My mom is a firefighter, but the best thing she can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
This is Peter Werby. Welcome to the broadcast. Thank you for joining me. So many years I've been urging everybody to take part in the political system through a variety of means, everything from voting to direct action, from citizens' assemblies to work in your church or your union or wherever else. But you can't do very much just by your little lonesome. You got to get involved. And I think we were just dealt recently a very harsh blow. That is, we the citizens, the capacity even organized to have an effect on government policy. And I'm speaking of this recent Supreme Court decision that overruled two important precedents. First Amendment rights of corporations were involved. The Supreme Court, it was 5-4, they ruled that government may not ban political spending by corporations in candidate elections. And Ralph Nader described this as the shredding of democracy. He said it shreds the fabric of our already weakened democracy by allowing corporations to more completely dominate our corrupted electoral process. He said that on counterpunch.org. Joining me is Craig Holman. Craig Holman is a public citizens government affairs lobbyist, and of course Public Citizen was founded by Ralph Nader in 1971. We reach Craig Holman in his Washington office. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hi, thanks, Peter. Glad to be here.
Do you take it to that extreme lengths that Ralph Nader does, shredding democracy?
Absolutely. This is a devastating decision. It just came out about 2 weeks ago, and it is an absolutely remarkable maneuver, a political maneuver by the U.S. Supreme Court. Before George Bush left office, he was able to appoint a narrow conservative majority on the Supreme Court, a 5-4 majority. Now, this court had picked up a fairly obscure minor case called Citizens United versus FEC that was just challenging a small provision of the McCain-Feingold Law of 2002. But what stunned everybody was on June 29th, last summer, this U.S. Supreme Court decided we're not going to rule on Citizens United. Instead, we're going to take a look at 100 years of political history in the United States that bans corporate involvement in politics, and we're going to rule on whether or not that's constitutional. Now, this is almost unheard of, largely because these laws, ever since the 1907 Tillman Act and the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, have not only been on the books, but they've been upheld by every Supreme Court prior to this last court, the Roberts Court. And stunningly, just about 2 weeks ago, the Roberts Court came out with their decision and basically declared that corporations shall be treated as human beings, just like you and I, under the First Amendment, and allowed unlimited corporate expenditures in elections. This is devastating. I mean, just to give little bit of perspective on this, this comes right on the wake of the 2008 elections, when for the first time in a long time, small donors chipping in $25 or $50 became sort of the major players in the presidential election. Now, suddenly, we have just thrown all that out the window, and we're turning the electoral process over to the major corporations that are, you know, Exxon just pulled in $20 billion in profits last year. That's the type of money that these corporations will now be allowed to spend without limits, limits.
Now, that trumps my $25 that I might send. Now, there's certainly a history on the Supreme, of activist, what's called activist decision. That is, trumping, to use that verb again, precedents, prior decisions, and you can think about ones that we all, most of us treasure, Brown versus Board of Education that overturned segregation, Roe v. Wade that allowed women the right of privacy in matters of reproductive rights. But we're looking at a court that's conservative, and it says that generally they don't like to make activist decisions. They like to stand on precedent. And so what was the motivation here? I mean, there wasn't harm being done. Like, there was harm being done to African-American students with segregated school. There were harm being done to women that had the law intervening in reproductive rights. What was the harm that motivated this conservative court in its majority to overturn the kind of precedents, Craig Holman, that you mentioned?
You can't really find a harm because Citizens United didn't even ask for this. This wasn't part of the court case. Citizens United was challenging the small provision of the McCain-Feingold law. They never were trying to overturn the 1907 Tillman Act or the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act. This was a decision made entirely and single-handedly by the new Supreme Court, led by Justice Roberts, by the way. Justice Roberts was just recently confirmed by the Senate on a promise to the Senate that he was not an activist and that he viewed his role as Chief Justice to be simply an umpire calling balls and strikes. Well, it took very little time for Roberts suddenly to turn this court into one of the most activist courts we've seen in a century. I mean, this is a devastating ruling.
Well, Craig Holman, as a government affairs lobbyist for Public Citizen, an extraordinarily valuable group doing tremendous work on behalf of the people of the United States, I'm sure you don't take part in language like this, but I've seen it used and even I've seen a cartoon saying essentially that the Supreme Court had just become horrors for the corporations. And that seems not just crass language, but, could there be a motivation that crass that these guys would say, yeah, let's destroy democracy. Let's give it all over to the big money. It seems even inconsistent with what we expect of mainstream conservatives like sit on the court.
Yeah, that may be crass language, and you know, I would be a little more careful in what type of language I would use, but this is how I would describe it. This is the remnants of the Bush administration. George Bush essentially devastated our economy over the last 8 years, largely by turning all, you know, authority when it comes to economic, you know, decision making and a great deal of political decision making over to corporations and the wealthy special interests. This court is the remnants of the Bush administration. So they are carrying on what we had rejected in 2008 and thought had finally left Washington, D.C., but it hasn't left. It's still here.
Craig Holman, you may have seen this article in the New York Times on January 22nd. It says, lobbyists get potent weapon in campaign ruling. The Supreme Court has handed lobbyists a new weapon, just what we're talking about. A lobbyist can now tell any elected official, if you vote wrong, my company, labor union, or interest group will spend unlimited sums explicitly advertising against your reelection. You're a government affairs lobbyist for Public Citizens. Why doesn't that put you and the Public Citizens programs, platforms, agendas on a stronger basis as well?
I am, in fact, a lobbyist, but I'm one of those that is supported by the $25 contributions and not the unlimited corporate budgets. You know, I give Hill briefings. I've been giving Hill briefings over the last week to explain to congressional staffers and to lawmakers the ramifications of this type of decision. And I'll tell you, there is a great deal of alarm and a great deal of energy when it comes to what this means for lawmaking. You know, we tend to address this decision too often in terms of just the fact that much more money is going to flow into politics and the small donors will no longer count. We won't count anymore. Now it's just going to be big money taking over elections. But just as damaging is the power it's going to give the lobbyists to Exxon, the lobbyists to Boeing, the lobbyists to any of these major corporations to walk into these lobby meetings with congressional staffers. And these staffers know that if they were to offend this lobbyist or not do what the lobbyist really wants on behalf of their corporate interests, that their boss is going to, you know, face the penalty come the election year. This is a major concern on Capitol Hill. Will Congress Congress, which hasn't done the greatest job at legislating lately, will they be able to do anything that challenges corporate authority? And that has now been called into serious question here.
We're talking with Craig Holman of Public Citizen. By the way, you can go to citizen.org, or if you want to fight this ruling, you can go to don'tgetrolled.org as well, although I think when you open up the citizen.org site, you'll get a link to the other site as well. And we're talking about the recent Supreme Court decision where the conservative majority ruled that government may not ban political spending by corporations in candidate elections, opening the floodgates of corporate money to essentially buy elections. Well, also always included in that, they always say corporations and unions. Is union lobbying and union being able to finance elections and candidates of the same magnitude of corporations?
Well, it's nowhere of the same magnitude, and even though the courts are going to open up a similar type of floodgate for union spending, I mean, they haven't done so yet. I want to highlight that. In the Citizens United decision, it focused only on corporate spending. So at this point, the courts just said corporations can spend unlimited amounts of funds. It will also allow unions to do so later on, as soon as unions fight for a similar type of, I want to use the word privilege and not rights. But, you know, unions rack up what, maybe 10% or much less in terms of political money than corporations. So they're going to be heavily outgunned, just like you and I are going to be outgunned. By the way, if I can provide some other interesting background.
Please.
About how sweeping this decision is. You know, the decision itself was 176 pages, but the bulk of that was actually the dissent written by Justice Stevens, who was just furious that the five conservative members on the court would open up this floodgate to corporate spending. And the shorter decision, which is the majority decision, just did such a sweeping declaration on behalf of unlimited corporate spending that it didn't even take the time or the prudence to find, you know, problem areas or to try to address overbreath. As a result, with this decision now, foreign nationals who had always been banned from making expenditures in U.S. elections will be able to do so if these foreign companies and foreign nationals have U.S. subsidiary corporations on American soil. They can merely funnel foreign money to influence our American elections at this point. Even it just as alarming to me is the fact that by opening up the floodgates to any CEO who wants to tap into this corporate treasury to spend the money on elections, you know, that's not his or her money. That actually is the money of shareholders, and it's even the money of all of us who invest in 401ks. Our 401k investment funds gets put into these corporate treasuries, and now with this Supreme Court ruling, the head of Exxon or the head of one of these major corporations can just take our money and spend it in elections, probably not on behalf of our interests, I may add. So we're going to see foreign money flow in here. We're going to see our own money being used against us. And we're just going to see so much more money flowing into politics. It's going to be disheartening.
Well, that's an interesting concept you said about our money. I never thought of it in that way. And I never really even look what stocks are held in my 401k. But say that some of it were, Gaia forbid, being invested in Exxon. Well, they could say, all right, we're going to get rid of, we're going to lobby for laws that would get rid of all environmental restrictions, minimum wage laws, safety laws, because they said then we'll make more money, because that's essentially what they're always all about, right? I don't mean necessarily getting rid of laws like that. I don't think they're that, again, a repeat of a word, that crass. But they're all about maximizing profit. When they give money to politicians, they see this they think about it in terms of return on investment, right? That they're going to buy certain politicians by financing their elections, and then this will allow legislation to be passed that will benefit their bottom line, and a lot of other things be damned.
Well, that's right. I mean, that is the ultimate purpose of any corporation, is to maximize profits. Now, by this Supreme Court deciding that these corporations are just like you and I, they are essentially determining that the single interest of maximizing profits for the corporate world has, as you know, the same constitutional rights as you and I in evaluating, you know, who should be elected president of the United States. I mean, this, we got to remember that corporations are artificial entities that were created by the states just to help individuals maximize their amount of financial resources for business purposes. They were never envisioned by the founding fathers as being actual persons entitled to vote or to get involved in politics. This is a business enterprise. And now we have this new court that's deciding to vest these artificial entities as if they were natural persons. And, you know, quite frankly, none of us natural persons have the same type of financial resources that these artificial entities have.
Sure.
And they're going to be able to use that money.
Well, Craig Holman, you mentioned some of these laws going back 100 years that forbid certain aspects of corporate funding of elections. But I'm remiss in not remembering the name of the book that was written by one of my colleagues, Tom Hartman, who's a nationally syndicated talk show host, who has a book about a Supreme Court decision in the late 1880s. That overturned a lot of state laws that forbid any attempt to influence legislation by businesses. Are you familiar with that, or is that...
I presume you're talking about the case Santa Clara County versus
right.
Southern Pacific Railroad.
That's
which
right.
was in 1886, I believe. And that is an interesting little case. The Supreme Court in that decision never did rule that corporations are persons under the Constitution. They just ruled that corporations have an equal protection to the laws, so they cannot be discriminated against. What happened was the clerk of the court decided a good way of phrasing that is to say, well, then we're saying that corporations are persons under the Constitution, which would give them all the First Amendment liberties and rights that you and I have. Well, that wasn't what the court ruled. And in fact, one of the justices even said to the clerk, you know, we never did say that. But they let that go in essentially as a footnote in this decision. And since that time, it has just mushroomed into what we just experienced about 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Supreme Court taking which was actually a footnote in a decision not written by a court itself and declaring that corporations are, in fact, persons like you and I.
Now, at the beginning of the program, I quoted Ralph Nader, who talked about that this decision by the Supreme Court to allow the corporations to fund candidates shreds the fabric of our already weakened democracy. Some people have said, hey, this just makes a little bit more real what had already gone on, that there already was such big money dominating all elections anyway, that this is just, I don't know, what sort of the corporations icing on the cake that they already had.
There was a lot of money involved in politics, and we all know that. So, I mean, that's what Public Citizen was dedicated to fighting, was undue corporate influence and also big money in politics. And we've achieved a lot until last week. You know, the corporate money had been allowed to start sliding into elections through what was called soft money. And in 2000 and 2002, for instance, there was about $500 million in corporate money being brought in through the back door as this soft money, designed not to influence elections because that was illegal, but designed to strengthen parties and party-building activities. It was used under that phrase. That's when we passed the McCain-Feingold law to ban that soft money. And that soft money was removed out of the national parties, out of the state parties, and also out of federal office holders. So we essentially really did a whole lot of work towards cleaning up the system. And, you know, as a result, we started seeing small donors donors become a much bigger player in the financing of elections. The Rehnquist Supreme Court in 2003 fully upheld almost all provisions of the McCain-Feingold law, saying, well, we understand Congress sees a problem with big money in politics, and so we respect the right to regulate that. It was the Roberts Court that suddenly has just thrown it all out.
Yeah, we were.
So I want to add. I mean,
sure.
even though some of this corporate money was slipping into politics anyway, now we actually have a decision by the Supreme Court saying there are no barriers, no walls to corporate money, and so expect the floodgates to open here.
And as we said earlier, there wasn't anything broken, so it didn't call for a radical fix, but we got it. What we're talking about with Craig Holman from Public Citizen, he's their government affairs lobbyist, is the recent Supreme Court decision, 5-4, the conservatives voting to open, as he just said, the floodgates to corporate spending during political campaigns. Now, from what I read, conservative and pro-business groups, as they call themselves, are considering lawsuits all over the country to block like 24 states that have campaign financing laws, including one here in Michigan. And I see in Texas, lawyers for Tom DeLay, the former House Majority Leader, the Republican, said that the pending state campaign finance criminal charges against him should be thrown out. So this has a lot of more aspects to it.
The consequences are enormous. About 24 states had prohibited corporate spending in their state elections, Michigan being one of them. These laws are about to be tossed out. When it comes to judicial elections, corporations are now going to be able to get involved in judicial elections and essentially elect your judges. When it comes to local politics, imagine this. I mean, you know, where in many localities, running for city council is just like a couple $1,000 campaign budget. Now any kind of developer at the local level or major business who wants a government contract can easily just lay down, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 to make sure that they will elect a new city council or a new local board in order to get what they want.
Well, Craig Holman, I'm just looking at the clock, and probably people saying, well, that's it. I'm not even going to bother to vote. It's all bought and sold. Why bother? Public Citizen, lots of other groups are not taking this lying down. What is what's afoot to stop this?
There are many remedies that are under debate, and most of them are about to be introduced on Friday here on Capitol Hill. But some of the stronger remedies that Public Citizen is advocating, one is a Shareholder Protection Act. If the CEO is going to spend other people's money, their corporate treasury money, on politics, we want to see a law mandating that CEO has to get permission from all shareholders. Let all shareholders vote on this. Make it public record so we all know how these CEOs are spending this corporate money. Just as importantly, we want to see a robust public financing program in order to give resources to lawmakers to try to offset what is expected to be this corporate onslaught in campaign spending. And finally, the most important thing we can do, and we're just beginning to move on this, is a constitutional amendment to clarify that corporations are not persons under the First Amendment. We just got Senator John Kerry to declare his support for this constitutional amendment just a couple hours ago.
That's great. And you can go to citizen.org or don'tgetrolled, R-O-L-L-E-D.org. I'll have a link on my website as well, peterwerby.com. Constitutional amendments, and that's really where it has to go, because right now the interpretation is that corporations are persons and have the right to speak through money. So this is a long, not very hopeful process, or is it?
I'm more optimistic. I've never been involved in a constitutional amendment before, so I know this is long term, but we can rein in a lot of the damage the court has done to us with a good Shareholder Protection Act and some good public financing legislation. It may take a while to get this constitutional amendment, but We have to. This is the option that we have to pursue to try to fix what this court's done. We either change the court or change the Constitution, and the five justices on this, the conservative justices on the court, are the young ones who aren't leaving anytime soon.
Well, I want to thank you so much for bringing this all to our attention, and most importantly, a remedy for it. And listeners, as I always say, you got two choices, either thatch or roof, just to admit we're powerless peasants, or get active. Great organization, citizen.org, public citizen it is, and their website, citizen.org. You can also go to the site, don'tgetrolled.org. Craig Holman, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIN. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
It's another new year, and your debt is higher than ever. Credit card balances that keep growing. Rising medical bills. Maybe you lost your job, or you're afraid of losing your home. That's the bad news. But you can work through your debt problems with help from Credit Card Relief. No, we're not a consolidation loan, not another one of those credit counseling deals, and not bankruptcy. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. If you're struggling with too much credit card debt, call us for a free consultation. We have an outstanding record of performance helping people get out of debt in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars. Call Credit Card Relief right now. The consultation is free and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
Do you want a wireless laptop, but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop, no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronics is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
Do you see chalky water spots on your dishes and tub that drive you crazy? Those spots are a warning that your plumbing may have a serious limescale buildup. What you can't see is limescale clogging your pipes, breaking down your appliances, and blocking their heating elements. And that could be costing you $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove hard water limescale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare. Just visit bestofwater.com. HydraCare has been sold for years by the major utility in England as the ideal treatment to reduce and prevent limescale. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents limescale buildup in your entire plumbing system. Guaranteed. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydraCare. Just go to bestofwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestofwater.com. That's bestofwater.com. 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
101 WRIF.
The Riff.
Hey, this is Lars from Metallica.
The Riff.
Hello, this is Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
The Riff.
Hello, this is Brian Johnson of AC/DC. You're listening to Detroit's home of rock and roll, WRIF.
Everything rocks.
Before we begin, are there any questions?
Getting you back to the rock.
101 WRIF.
The Riff.
Cowboy.
Well, I'm packing up my game and I'ma head out west, where real women come equipped with scripts and fake breasts. Find a nest in the hills, chill like Flint, buy an old drop top, find a spot to pimp. Then I'm a kid, rock it up and down your block with a bottle of scotch and watch lots of crotch. Buy a yacht with a flag saying chilling the most, then rock that beast, jump and down. Stars, get thrown in the mix and tossed out of bars. Sip the Tijuana, I wanna roam. Find old town, telling fools to come back home. Start an escort service for all the right reasons and set up shop at the top of Four Seasons. Kid rocking, I'm the real McCoy, and I'm headed out west, sucker, because I wanna be a cowboy, baby.
With a top left and the sunshine shining.
Cowboy, baby.
Right now.